It's a tremendous sadness of like, there's death in life. And I still hate it. I don't want it to be true. But it's reality. So you can't do it well if you don't face it. That's the thing. And there's no out. Like once you're here and you've been born, so many things are going to die to make your life possible. And so the only option at that point is just to accept it, to make a vow to do it well, to be humble before it, and just to be really grateful.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Death in the Garden podcast. This is Marin.
And this is Jake, and this is episode number 4 with Lierre Keith,
the author of The Vegetarian Myth.
If you haven't already, we really encourage you to listen to to episode number 3, the preceding episode, because it's kind of like a preface for this episode where we really talk about some personal stories and experiences that kind of led us to Lierre Keith's book, The Vegetarian Myth, and why it is so important to us and why we resonated with it so much. We kind of talk about some of those ideas. So we encourage you to listen to that one first if you can, but if not, this is great regardless.
Yeah, Lierre Keith is super, super fucking smart. This whole interview was just, you know, we just learned so much talking to her. So this is a really, really good resource for a lot of the information that we're talking about. It kind of originated with Lierre Keith. So this is a really important interview, and we're happy to share it with you guys.
Yeah, I think this was probably so far like our favorite interview that we did because it was almost 3 hours. Well, it was 3 hours long, and we just covered so much topic in depth and just covered such a wide array of things. And she was so giving with her time and energy, and we had such a fun time talking to her.
Yeah, she was really, really wonderful. And you can hear it in the podcast too. We just had a lot of fun talking to her.
Lierre Keith is a very smart, intelligent, empathic, caring person who, isn't willing to compromise on silly ideas and is a proponent of adult knowledge. As a heads up, if you've listened to our other episodes, we kind of alluded to this. When we first started filming this project, we didn't really think we were doing a podcast. We were conducting all these conversations and interviews as if they were going to be, you know, sound bites for our film that we were going to go through and find the bits and pieces that were going to help us construct our narrative. But as we started doing these interviews, especially, I really think when we did the Lierre Keith interview, we kind of realized...
We're like, oh, fuck.
Oh, fuck. This was... Because it turned into a really cool conversation. It wasn't just like an interview and us getting her to recite her shtick. It was like this really cool conversation we had that it really seemed like it was going to be a shame to not show everybody the whole thing and just the sound bites. So this is the first of the interviews we are releasing that weren't filmed or recorded as podcasts. All the audio equipment was just on Lierre Keith. You can hear us in the background. So we've done as good of a job as we can to cut out the bits and pieces where it's essentially just dead air, where you can't really hear us asking questions. Mm-hmm. There's stuff we left in where it's still very quiet, where we're kind of asking her questions, we're leading her to the next topic. But luckily, 98% of this interview was her talking.
Yeah, and her saying the really cool stuff. So we don't feel like anyone's going to be kind of missing out. But, you know, you won't hear my voice very much because I was farther away from the mic. So it's kind of hard to tell that I was there, but I was there.
Yeah. So if it sounds kind of weird and if it sounds like we did a little bit of editing, we did. We didn't do any mixing around or changing the topic. It was just like there was dead space where you could hear us. So, you know, for your sake, we just tried to cut out the excess kind of bullcrap and just keep the good stuff. But it is a little weird. It's a little wonky. We thought about, like, re-recording our questions.
And it sounded so stupid. It sounded so dumb.
Maybe if we were better at it, we could do it. But we figured we'd just be as genuine as possible and just give you a heads up that this wasn't recorded as a podcast, but it's still a fascinating conversation and interview. So we really hope you enjoy it.
Yeah. Enjoy, everyone.
You know. Well, the thing about that whole issue, you know, when you talk about things like, quote, whatever you want to call it, overpopulation, the land has carrying capacity. You know, there's a certain number of each organism that can exist and no more. And what evolution does is it figures out how to make that community. So there's always two counterbalancing things going on. And one is that each individual organism is evolving and putting new pressures on the rest of the community. And then there's the folding back in and making the community function again as a community. So there's both things going on at once. You know, there's pressure for each one to individuate and try more new things and figure out new niches. And all that has to happen for life to continue because everything is constantly changing. And evolution is an amazing thing in that regard. But evolution also only works as a community. So you've got both things going on at once. You have the individuation and then you have the folding back in. And for that to work, it means that there's always like, you know, a shifting number of creatures that can live in any one place. And so it's going to be a little higher when they figure out, oh, we could eat this instead and evolve to eat that. Then it's going to, the population's going to crash a little bit because what do you know, the weather has changed a little more or, you know, this creature has figured out how to eat you a little bit better. And so there's always going to be this back and forth. But, you know, in any given time period, only so many creatures are going to be able to live there, whether it's wolves or humans or redwood trees or whatever. And there's only so many that the community can support as a whole. And evolution is really good at figuring that out. And humans blew past it. And that's the problem. I mean, it's true for every creature. And everyone always talks about the bacteria in the wine bottle, in the wine barrel. And, like, that's a simple... You know, it's like we all get the image, and that's true. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of them, and then there's more and more and more, and then it's huge, and then there's none. Because they reached carrying capacity, and then they crashed. And that's essentially what we're doing. And it's foolish to pretend that the Earth does not have limits, because it does. And the thing that kills me about this is that for most of our time on this planet, humans got that. And if you look at hunter-gatherer societies, they know exactly... What there's a ratio of dependent, so either old people or babies, you know, very young, and functioning adults who are going to get the food. And everybody knows what that ratio is. So you can't bring more people in, you know, unless you've got enough adults to care for them. And everybody knows that. And I'm not saying that it would be fun to have to take care of that, but everybody knows you have to. And so, you know, the one example that, you know, always stands out for me is a lot of the people that live in the far north above the Arctic Circle. Like if a woman's husband died and she had any children that were under 3 years old, I mean, this is just utterly gruesome. She had to kill the children because there aren't enough adults, especially in such a harsh environment, but there aren't enough adults for everyone to be fed. And everybody knows that we are all going to be hungry. And this is what you have to do. And I can't imagine how they did it, but they did have to, because otherwise you're all hungry. So usually it's not that grim, but indeed everybody gets that there's, you know, we can only have so many children every year, and they know how to space children. Like everybody gets where babies come from. Like we know how to avoid this. But you have to do your part. Like it's, you know, you will be socially, you know, whatever, shunned if you, you know, break the rules. And the rules aren't there to be mean. They're there because there's a carrying capacity of the land. And if we eat too many deer or too many buffalo or too many salmon berry or too many salmon or whatever, there's only enough to go around before we are degrading our land base. And degrading a land base means we are destroying it bit by bit. And it means at the end of the day, we're headed toward famine and we know that's not going to be any fun. So instead, we'd live with our limits. And knowing those limits was never seen as anything bad until very recently. Like that was what you did as a human being. You lived in a humble way and in a good way and in a prayerful way. And you said, thank you. And you only took what you needed. And I don't know why that's wrong. Like to just admit that the world has physical limits and that we are only one species among so many, so many. And we are so dependent on them. We can't do any of this for ourselves. We can't make oxygen. We need the plant people to do that for us. And that's why there are, you know, in so many cultures, they're considered our grandparents. They're our elders because they were here first and they figured that out. And that's what they do. They make oxygen. So they made that, you know, we have the blanket of the atmosphere. You know, we've got the cradle of soil and then the blanket of air. And that is why animals are here. But we need those other creatures to do that. And so we need to be thankful and humble and live in reverence with that. And that means accepting our limits. So all this stuff about like the overpopulation, like I just don't get it. Like, how do you not see that? Like 40% of the direct energy that come, what they call the productive capacity of the planet. So the direct energy and then the plants photosynthesizing, 40% of that goes directly to humans on the entire planet. And another 40% of the indirect capacity of the planet also goes to humans. That's a full 80%. Like this is not sane. Like this can't go on. You can't just devour the web of life and think there's going to be a planet at the end of the day. Like, and so I can't understand, like, we've got to face what we've done if we have any hope of pulling back, like, in a decent way. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, they're really looking at, like, Mad Max scenarios as, like, a happy ending for all of us. Like, desert and buzzards, really? I mean, that's, it's not going to end well. And I don't get it. And especially when the solutions are so easy and so obvious and so good. Like, there are things we should be doing anyway. Because the number one thing that drops the birth rate, and this has been studied, like, backwards, forwards, inside out, the number one thing you can do to drop the birth rate is teach a girl to read. It's that simple. When women and girls have that much more power over their lives, they choose to have fewer children. And that's all anybody, that's it. Like, if we all have education, healthcare, food, basic human rights to decide what we're going to do with our lives, that's what happens. Women decide to have fewer children. And as it turns out, what most couples want is about two kids. When everything else is provided for, when we all have what we need, it turns out most people want two children, which is replacement levels. Like, was that really so hard? Like, it's actually what we all want at the end of the day. So why don't we just do it? I don't understand. Like, we should be doing those things anyway. Like, we should make sure girls are educated. We should make sure everybody has food and healthcare. These are basic human rights. So why is this so terrifying for everybody to talk about when there's such good solutions and things we should care about anyway? And at the end of the day, it's the only way to save the planet. Because it was never people versus the planet. It was like one social system versus the planet. It's always people plus the planet. Because we're animals too, and we need our home. And until very recently, we loved our home. And so this kind of thing just makes me insane. Like, what? Why are we vilifying people who just want to talk about the problem? Especially when the solutions are such good solutions. Like, they're the things that we should really all want, just with all of our hearts. Like, of course I want little girls to get an education. And of course I want women to have control over their bodies. And of course I want couples to decide how many children they have. And everybody should have food. And if we do that, wow, look what happens. The population just contracts dramatically. Really quickly, too. So, like, why is this even something we have to fight about? Let's just do it. Like, simple solution. It's not a horrible thing. Like, this is, people are confused. I get it. Because we've had, like, the one child policy in China, some horrible things happening in Cuba. Like, they're definitely, like, just wretched human rights abuses that have happened, especially to women, you know, when people start talking about population control. So I get it. But we're not talking about population control. You know, we're talking about empowering women and girls while we save the planet. So it's a completely different analysis, and it's a completely different set of solutions. And I get that people conflate that because, I mean, that stuff's like evil and ugly and they don't want anything to do with that. But we don't have to have such an emotional overreaction that we can't, you know, examine the real solutions and then be happy that they're good solutions. And nobody has to be forced to be like sterilized or have a forced abortion or like, you know, just evil, evil things that have happened. Like, we don't, none of that is on the table. It won't help, and we don't need to do it. So, like, no, just put it aside. Like, it's not a thing. We don't need it. We need the good things to happen on this planet, and we can have those things. So, yeah.
And so I went through, so reading your book was like, it was like, you were putting words to so many things that I wanted to say to people, and I just want to kind of cover those things.
Sure, let's have it.
So why did you go vegan? What were those intentions?
So I became a vegan in the way that most people become vegan, which is that I met another vegan. And that is the number one way that people get introduced to either vegetarianism or veganism. They meet somebody and they are convinced. So I was convinced. I was 16 years old and I was already a very impassioned, I felt the pain of the world. Always had. I mean, it just was a very sensitive child. And I looked out and I could see that things were very bad and probably going to get worse. And I wanted to understand why, and I wanted to do something about it. And I knew that's why I was here. So I met this other teenage girl and her whole family, they were vegans, and didn't take 2 weeks. And I was totally convinced that this was the way forward. And she had, I mean, this was long before the internet. So she had brochures and she had books and she had all her arguments, and she was very well spoken, very articulate, super smart. And I really liked her and I liked her family, and it all just seemed so wholesome. And she was right. Like, these were incredible arguments, and they were obvious, right? They seemed just self, like, explanatory. If you just do this one thing, you can save animals and you can save the planet and you will do better things for your health. And there'll be more human justice, like there'll be more food for people. So you're going to stop world hunger. And like, how could I say no to this? Like, from every angle, all the things that I cared about were immediately going to be fixed if I just did this one thing. So then my job was to tell other people to do this one thing. But I could do that. Like, I could see my way to doing that. Like, this was something I could take up for my life and have this be the cause. So I did it. Within 2 weeks was just, that's it. I'm going to be a vegan. So I had to figure out what food to buy and what was tofu. I'd never heard of it. And I mean, this was only 1980. So a lot of people hadn't heard of tofu at that point, but, now I think you'd be hard pressed in America not to have heard of tofu, but that was a weird thing at the time. So yeah, I had to learn to eat all these new foods and I had to learn how to cook them and all this, but it felt like I'm doing the right thing. So, and I mean, I grew up in a very kind of urban edge of suburbia. It was all cement and I didn't know where my food came from. I knew that I cared about animals a great deal and that I didn't want them to suffer, but I had no counterweight to what she was saying. I had no way to know if any of this was true or not. And certainly the pictures of animals in factory farms was very compelling. And still, I mean, that stuff is horrible. And no matter what you decide to eat at the end of the day, I think we can all agree that that stuff just has to stop. So we've got some agreement no matter what. But yeah, it was all very convincing. And I didn't have any way to know that most of what she was telling me was not in fact true. It seemed true, like it could be true. So the problem is you dive in with this kind of stuff. And I think that one of the biggest problems about being a vegan is that it becomes your identity. It's not just what you eat. It's like who you are. So now you've got a whole nother level of problems when you start to question it or anybody else comes at you with other information that might disturb that. It's not just, you know, an intellectual debate where you could sort of lay your facts on the table and see how it stacks up. It really feels like a threat to your sense of self. And that makes it really hard. And I have learned to be very cautious of that sort of thing at this point in my life. But I had to learn that lesson the hard way. Like, don't make this your identity because you can be very wrong. You can be really wrong about stuff. And if you put up that kind of a wall, you know, where learning new information is going to threaten me, that's a fundamentalist mindset, honestly. And, you know, I did all this in the service of not being a fundamentalist, of being someone who was engaged and curious and wanted the information. I wanted to know how bad it was out there so that I could do something about it. So, I mean, I always was very intellectually curious. And then I drew this really hard line, like, but I don't want to know about that because that's a threat to my vegan worldview. So it was a real push-pull for a good 20 years because I was still learning and I was very actively learning about things, especially when it came to food. I wanted to grow my own food. I knew that was one of the best things you could do for the planet was make your food miles zero, like do it in your own backyard. And I wanted to be engaged with that and very quickly, you know, hit the wall with there's not really a way to do this as a vegan. And that was really disturbing. And in the meantime, I'm also reading books about, well, what is agriculture? Like, what is this thing called agriculture? And where did it come from? And why do we do it? And this is the good food, right? The peaceful food, the sustainable food. And like everything I read was, actually, no, this is the worst thing people have done to the planet. Like, these two things can't both be true. So I rode that line. It was, you know, that was the angel I wrestled all those years. Like, this is true. No, it can't be true. And then I would put those books away. I was like, I can't face this. It's too disturbing to me. But it has to be true. But it can't be true. But like, then what is true? And I'm like, no, don't think about it anymore. So, you know, that was one of the good things about giving up being a vegan was finally, it was like this flood of all that information that I had gathered all those years. Like, I can finally just sit and think about this. What do I now know to be true? What have people done to the planet? Why have they done it to the planet? Where did the wound start? Like, where did the destruction begin? And the answer, honestly, is agriculture. So all those vegan answers were just wrong. I mean, they came from the best possible place, but it was all wrong.
I'd like to kind of cover, you know, this idea of, like, the resources that it takes for meat and all the arguments about,
sure,
like, how taxing that is. And it's really just coming from the factory farm.
Yes, though. Absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of what you'll hear from, say, vegans or the global warming people or, you know, various, you know, political lobbies is all about how resource intensive meat is. And I think that there is, you know, at least one sort of section of this that we can all agree to, which is that factory farming is all of those things. It does take a lot of grain, and it does take a lot of water, and it does take, you know, a lot of land and all of this. So we've got two things going on. The first is what they say about factory farming. Is that stuff true? And then, oh, but is that the only way that we can make meat? And those are two really, really different areas. The problem is they tend to conflate them. So you really have to kind of pick that apart a bit and just sort of keep those in separate categories, you know, as you try to engage with those arguments. So the first one, the factory farming, I think that, you know, anybody with a pulse can agree that it's really wrong to torture animals. Like, we just need to set this aside now as a culture and just stop. So, I mean, that's a movement that I think anybody should support, because it's just wrong. There's no good reason for it. So it's not like there's some, you know, overwhelming evidence that we have to do this for some terrible reason. Like, we don't. Like, there's no reason to keep doing this to sentient beings. So set that aside. So then you get to arguments like, well, 16 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of beef. I've heard 18 pounds. I've heard 20 pounds. You know, and I believed those things. I mean, those were statistics that I threw out at people a lot over the years. It turns out that that's not even true. That, in fact, the bulk of what animals eat, even in those terrible situations, it turns out that those are things that humans can't eat or that we don't want to eat. It's both. Most of it's what's called agricultural byproducts. So, for instance, soybeans, you've got a, you know, monocrop of soy, then the part of the soy that humans want is really the oil. So the beans are pressed and then the oil is used. I don't consider soybean oil edible, but put that aside. The point is that in the industrial food system that we have, that's the part they want is the oil. And what's left over is this sort of mash from the beans. Humans don't want that. Like, we don't eat that. That's one of the things they give to chickens and cows, is that mash. So that's one really good example. Or, for instance, they make white flour and they take off the bran, you know, like the germ of the... We don't really eat that. Like, everybody wants the white flour and the white donuts and the crackers and whatever. That's an agricultural byproduct. That's another thing that gets fed to chickens and cows and pigs. It's stuff we don't want. A lot of it is just out-and-out cellulose. So it's stuff we literally have no way to digest. And this goes back to the sort of traditional model of farming where you know, post-agriculture. So say you would have a field of grain, but you would rotate that field with cows, pigs, chickens, whatever. And at the end of the harvest, you know, we're only eating the seed. You know, if you're eating wheat, if you're eating grain, you're eating that little tiny bit. The rest of that plant, the stalk, the leaves, we can't eat it. We don't digest cellulose. We are not animals that do that. Ruminants are. They're the ones that figured out that whole process. And they have four stomachs and they have all this bacteria. And that's how digestion happens inside a cow. So you would harvest your grain and then all that stuff that was left over in the field, the cows would then, or the pigs or whoever, would be led in to eat it. Because we don't eat it. We can't. So a lot of that is fed to cows and whatnot in factory farms. And again, that is stuff that humans don't eat. So even when they're saying, oh, it's 18 pounds of grain, yeah, you might be giving cows 18 pounds of corn or whatever, but mostly not. Mostly you're giving them stuff that we don't even want. So it ends up being like 12, 13% of their diet is actually stuff that's in direct competition with humans. The vast bulk of it is not. So, and even in terms of, you know, the horrors of factory farming, what cows are doing is, you know, recirculating nutrients. They're taking stuff that we can't eat or don't want to eat, and they're turning it into nutrition that humans can eat. And that's not in any way an argument for factory farming, because it's awful stuff. But just taking that argument on its face, they're not, in fact, like taking things from humans or, you know, wasting food that could go to humans, because that's not what's happening. They're eating stuff that we either don't want or can't eat and turning it into very edible things for humans and nutrition that humans do need. So they're wrong about that. Then you get to things like water, and it's just sort of silly because it'd be like, you know, 2,000 gallons or 10,000 gallons, like this ever-increasing amount of water. It's like, yeah, cows drink water. And then they pee, and like it comes out the other end. Like, where do you think it goes? They're not ever expanding balloons. I mean, it's just silly. So really what they mean is the water that goes into the agricultural products that some of the cows are then eating. Yeah, all right, that takes water. But the real problem then is, why are we growing grain if it takes that much water? Because again, the cows are only eating stuff that we don't want. So it's not really, it's not really an argument that holds water. That's not really an argument that holds up, because it's the water is not being used to feed the cows. It's being used for other things, and then the cows eat some of it, but it's not directly going to cows. So that's the water. And then there's other stuff like energy, but that gets kind of tricky because it depends where is the cow, you know, like, where is this happening? How far is it from you? All these concepts about food miles. I mean, some of the most energy intensive food is things like lettuce, because we have, you know, like the 2000 mile Caesar salad. It's kind of ridiculous. It's like 98% water in that little bin, and that's being shipped across the country. I mean, that's madness. No matter what we all decide to eat, that's crazy world. We got to stop that. So anyway, so those are some of the arguments about sort of the resource arguments that don't really stack up.
We were listening to the podcast with Diana, and especially the water argument, the numbers they're portraying don't take into the fact that there's a thing called green water and blue water.
Right.
So there's the actual water that has to get shipped in, whatever, and there's water that's the rainfall.
Right.
And a massive amount of that statistic is just natural rainfall.
It's just rainfall.
Well, yeah, it takes water, but the water was going to fall
anyway.
And continue to cycle
in
the system.
I know.
And it's also like, how about all the water that humans actually waste?
Yeah.
We like shit in water. And
I know, right? It's crazy.
So I'd like to unpackage, you know, because now we think that, okay, well, growing plants is harmless. Right. When in fact, why is plant agriculture so harmful to the soil, to the environment, you know?
So when I was 19, I had a professor who pretty thoroughly destroyed my vegan worldview with one sentence. And what he said was, the moment you put a plow to soil, you degrade that soil. And what happened was, I could see instantly, like A, B, C, D, E, like from beginning to end, like it just felt like dominoes. So we do this thing called agriculture, which means you're destroying it. We're destroying the soil. If he's right, we're destroying the soil every time we do this. So that means that once that soil is destroyed, you now have to take more. Well, then that soil is going to get destroyed, so now you have to take more. There's only so many inches on the planet, right? There's only so many acres. Eventually, we've used it all. In the meantime, of course, every time we do this, the human population grows because we're taking over more and more land. So the population is growing, the available land is shrinking, and then it's going to be shrinking at an ever-increasing rate because if he's correct, we're destroying it. This doesn't end anywhere but over a cliff. And I was utterly horrified. Because up to that point in my vegan life, I thought, well, I'm doing the right thing. This is the sustainable food and the good food and the peaceful food and the food of the future and how we're going to fix all the problems. And then all of a sudden he tells me, this is actually an inherently destructive activity. I was like, how can this be? This was supposed to be the fix for all of it. And in fact, it's the problem. So yeah, I mean, he was right. The moment you put a plow to soil, you degrade that soil. There were humans, something like humans on this planet for 2.5 million years. And we were not monsters and destroyers. We lived as hunter-gatherers of some variety. And we lived as members of communities. We lived inside those communities and we took our nourishment from inside them like every other species does. And then sometime about 10,000 years ago in a few places around the globe, people took up this wholly different activity that's called agriculture. And there's a lot of theories about why. But regardless, people started to do this. And from that point forward, everything changes because that activity means that you are destroying your land. So instead of living inside those communities with, you know, those biotic communities that are just dense with life and all those creatures doing that work together to create more, to strengthen the web and make, you know, more resilience and more species and, you know, ever increasing ways for all of us to help each other and eat each other and, you know, make more of each other. You wipe out all that land and all. And that's what agriculture is that you take that chunk of land and you clear every living thing off it. And I mean down to the bacteria, like all the life is removed bit by bit. And then you just plant one thing and it's all for humans. So all of that life is gone. So it's biotic cleansing is what I call it. I mean, we've all heard of ethnic cleansing. Well, this is like that, only worse, because it's everything. It's every last living creature is removed. So right now, we are losing 200 species every day. Driven into extinction, 200 species every day. And it's because of what we're doing. It's this thing called agriculture. That's the problem. This is not the solution. And that was where I went so wrong, being a vegan. I didn't know that. You know, this was the thing I had to try to figure out. So that pattern of doing agriculture, we call that civilization. So civilization is not the same as culture. A lot of people get confused. Culture is just what humans do. We all humans make culture. It's how we learn. It's how we live. It's how we teach our children. It's what we eat. It's how we worship. All of that makes a culture. It's like the total life way. And we are storytelling creatures. We are also what they call hypersocial because we really need each other. We're very dependent as young beings. I mean, you look at baby birds or whatever, you know, baby horses, like mostly they're up and running within an hour. And that is so not true for humans. It takes us so long to be independent. And what that means is we really need a tribe. We need a lot of other people around us to help us get to maturity. So they call us hypersocial. That's the word for it. So we really need each other. And so the problem is that, you know, there's this one pattern of human culture, and that's called civilization. That's the one where the destruction begins. It's not humanity. It's not human nature. So I just want to be really clear that people get that. It's not, oh, this sort of vague greed. People have done this terrible thing, and it's because we somehow are broken. No, that's not it. We were alive on this planet 2.5 million years. We didn't destroy the place. From what I can tell, we had a really good time, and we made some very beautiful art, and clearly, you know, we had music and we had jewelry and we made clothes and, like, you know, we were doing rituals. And it seems to me we had a lot of reverence and awe for who was giving us life, because the first art we ever made, two things, the megafauna and the megafemales. And that's Thanksgiving. I mean, what else could that be? That's why we're here. So all the cave paintings and the carvings, it's all two things. It's big, fat, pregnant women. And it's the giant animals, the megafauna that we were eating. That's what's on those cave paintings. And that's the little sculptures that everybody finds all around the world. So it wasn't about destruction until very, very recently. So people take up agriculture and an entirely new way of life begins that we call civilization. So what does civilization mean? Well, it's people living in densities that require the importation of resources. So if you think about a city, what is that? Well, at this point, it's all cement. But even back in the day before it was cement, it would have been what? Like a whole bunch of buildings, some stone. The point is there's not enough land for that place to support you. You've destroyed it all. So the food, the water, the energy have got to come from somewhere else, because the city has destroyed its own and built on it, right? At that point, you're going to have to go out and get that stuff and bring it back in. And that's called imperialism. You're going to have to conquer your neighbors to get it, because nobody willingly gives up their land, their water, their trees, their fish, whatever. You're going to have to take it from them. And that is the pattern of civilization. There's too many people. They've used up all the resources that their land had. They've destroyed the soil, because that's what you do when you do agriculture. You have a temporary advantage because there's more of you, but that advantage can't last, because it's what's called drawdown. Every year that you plant those crops, you're destroying the soil more and more and more. So at a certain point, you're going to have less and less and less food. So again, you have to go out and get that stuff from somewhere else. And that's the pattern of civilization. Every single civilization that has existed has done exactly this. They've used up their own stuff. They've destroyed their forests. They've destroyed their soil. They've destroyed their waterways. They've destroyed their coastline. They take it all, and then they go and they conquer their neighbors. So because people can specialize, then you start to have this hierarchy. So you've got the king usually on top. Sometimes the king and the priest are the same person. Sometimes the religion's a little bit under the king. And then the next layer in the hierarchy is, of course, the military. And the military is huge. And so there's an entire class of people who can devote themselves to war. And they can do this because at the bottom of the pyramid are the slaves. And they are the ones doing the backbreaking labor of agriculture. And they create a surplus. And that surplus means that the soldiers don't have to make food. They can just eat and go out and fight. So you have a professional class that's about war and about conquering. And they go out and they get the food and they bring it back into the power center. They one of the things they bring back is also other people, because this is where slavery begins. Up until that point, hunter-gatherers don't need slaves. They have no way to keep slaves. How would you even contain them? I mean, it's like a completely bizarre concept. But the moment you get to agriculture, this is when this begins. So yeah, they get the slaves. The slaves are doing the backbreaking labor. They don't live very long. And that's one of the things you take from your neighbors, is you make them into your slaves. And then, you know, eventually the whole thing is going to collapse, because after you use up all that stuff, especially the soil, there's nothing left. And then at some point, it's just, you've got the collapse coming. And civilizations last between maybe 800 and 2,000 years, literally until the soil gives out. And once the soil is gone, that civilization is over. There's only so much you can import. Until you got to fossil fuel use. Before then, every civilization was limited geographically because of those supply chains. There was only so far that you could go and get stuff and bring it back in. That was increased, say, around the Mediterranean, where there were like rivers or like, you know, giant bodies of water. You could use that to navigate and to bring back resources and also to fight wars. But even that had a limit. There was a natural limit to all of this. So, for instance, Northern Europe was pretty safe from the Roman Empire because of the Alps. They just couldn't get up and down the Alps to conquer the rest of it. They could get around, you know, some like all the way to England and all that, but they couldn't get, you know, up into the more northern part of Europe because of the mountain ranges. There just isn't a way to do it before fossil fuel. So they sort of had a natural limit, civilizations, and that process just, you know, kept going over and over again. So that civilization would collapse. So, you know, you have all around the Mediterranean, you know, you have like ancient Egypt, and then you have the Phoenicians, and then you have the Greeks, and then you have the Romans. So it just sort of keeps moving around, you know, like, okay, well, now we've got a new forest and there's new soil. And we're, you know, we're going to take all that. Okay, well, that one will collapse now. We're going to have another one. So it just sort of bops around until like the whole region is just essentially in a state of collapse. The whole thing went global once humans figured out how to use fossil fuel, because all of those limits broke. So now the whole thing is just on a planetary scale. At least in the past, when civilizations collapsed, there would be the hinterland. There would be still some hunter-gatherers out in the, you know, the fields, or, you know, like out past where the, you know, the boundary was, you would still have some intact forest that was sort of beyond what the civilization could reach. So when it collapsed, some people could go home. Like, you could go back to the people of the forest. You could go back to the people of the, you know, the wilderness, the wasteland, and, you know, take up life again there. So humans could at least survive. We're beyond that now, though. There's nothing left. 98% of the world's old growth forests and 99% of the world's prairies are gone. They have simply been taken, and they have been taken for this process. They have been taken for agriculture. That's it. So I think there's, what, 42 tribes left of hunter-gatherers on the planet? And that's it. Everybody else has been brought into this, whether we wanted to be or not. We've all been conquered. All of us come from those roots. You know, if you go back far enough, you will find your people, but it's over. Like, that's, for most of us, it's just long gone, and there's nowhere to go back to. Like, we're stuck here. So, yeah, so that's the pattern, and it's called civilization, and it destroys the planet. It destroys, you know, both locally and globally, it's destroyed the ecosystem. It's been incredibly destructive to human societies, because there's a lot of argument for hunter-gatherers being at least partly, you know, more egalitarian, that you don't have that kind of stratification. There's often equality between the sexes. A lot of good can be said for the ways that, the sort of life ways that we all come from, you know, if you go far enough back. But that's not true about agricultural societies. They always end up militarized. They end up imperialists. They end up committing genocide. You know, they end up being, you know, like, even with like the best values in their hearts, even if they have religions that talk about peace or love or, you know, having compassion for other beings, whatever, the moment that you take up this process called agriculture, it's inevitable. Like, your society is functionally dependent on imperialism, genocide, male domination, militarism, all of that is going to come into play eventually because you're going to have to conquer your neighbors. And that's what you need to do it. So that conflict is always going to be there as long as you're doing this destructive activity. So it's built in, like it's a feature, not a bug. And that's the problem. So as well as destroying, you know, all of those species that we will never see again. I mean, their extinction is forever. We've also destroyed our human relationships with each other that, you know, we could have just nicely traded. I have some abalone shell and you have some obsidian. Hey, let's trade. Like, we could have done that and I'll teach you my songs and you show me how you make your baskets. Well, that's long gone. Now it's, you know, I want your oil and how am I going to get it? So that's where we are. A lot of this changes around the year 1800. It gets a lot worse because that's, you know, more or less the beginning of the industrial age. So you got coal and you have oil and gas. Humans figure out that there's this very widely available, cheaply accessible fuel source. And what can we do with this? So they invent machines. And all of this is just a way to get more. So it's a way to take more of the living community, turn it into dead commodities, and then turn that into private wealth. So there's been an explosion of that, the private wealth being hoarded, first being created and then being hoarded. And this is the problem that I have with a lot of the, you know, leftist analysis that I might otherwise agree with, that, you know, the problem for them begins with, well, the, you know, like they would say that what's gone wrong is that wealth needs to be widely shared. So the problem begins at the point of, oh, how is the wealth being distributed? Like, rather being hoarded, we should all have it. And my problem starts way previous to that, where, you know, when you've got this system where living beings are turned into, you know, dead commodities, that's the problem. It's not, we need to share those dead commodities. It's like, why are we turning the planet into a consumer wasteland? I mean, that's really the issue. It's not about, that just seems utterly backwards to me to say the problem is, well, we should all share it. No, like, we shouldn't be doing it. I mean, we've got to stop the death, not stop the hoarding. Like, it's way prior to where they identify the problem. And ultimately, that problem starts with agriculture. So, yeah, year 1800, a lot of this really kicks off. The interesting thing, though, is that the problem was always inherent in this activity and in that pattern that results from it. So you can talk about global warming. And like, we've all seen the hockey stick graph, you know, starts at 1800 and boom, like up goes the carbon. And that's true. I mean, it's absolutely true. But if you back that graph up like 6,000, 7,000 years, the same amount of carbon was released into the atmosphere from the beginning of agriculture to the year 1800, as has been released from 1800 till now. So it took a lot longer, but it's still just as destructive. And it wasn't burning fossil fuel that did it. You know what we were burning through? Fossil soil. And it was from destroying it through agriculture. It literally just vaporized. And where did it go? All that carbon is stuck up in the air now. So we got one way to get it back, and it's to repair the planet. And the quickest way to do that is grasslands and grazers. So we need the ruminants and the grasses, and that's really our only hope.
Having read your book, you speak so beautifully about the American prairie, and I'm now obsessed with this idea of, like, you know, somewhat restoring the prairie.
Yeah.
What was the American prairie, and what stories can you speak about what the American wilderness was? You had that story of, like, you could go from Maine to Texas,
yeah,
theoretically,
yeah,
in treetops. You know, what was it like, and where are we at now?
Yeah. So some of the historic records, and so this is like stuff that people wrote down. This isn't a myth. Just this vast area in the interior of our continent that was where the buffalo roamed, and that some of that soil was 12 feet deep. Like, that's how much fertility grasses and ruminants can create. And the historic record is that, you know, you could sit on a rock for 4 days and watch as a single herd of bison thundered by. And I just can't even imagine that much life. Like, 4 days. And they're not just ambling. Like, they're running full speed. That's how many animals are in one herd. Like, it would just be uncountable amounts. The number of bison that were here just running past you day by for 4 days straight. That's how much life there was on those prairies. So they say it was probably about 60 million bison. And there would have been, I think, 20 million elk, 10 million antelope, 10 million prairie dogs, I want to say. And then all the other creatures, too, that lived there. You know, you had, like, black-footed ferrets and hawks and, like, everybody's eating each other and doing these things. But there were, like, prairie dog colonies that went on for 100 miles. Like, it's just like that's a city of prairie dogs. Like, how many prairie dogs were under there? It's just, it's absolutely extraordinary. And it was the same here in the Pacific Northwest, that there were so many fish. You could hear them coming when they returned. Because, you know, the salmon, they spend their lives in the, they breed in the freshwater and then they go back out to the ocean and then they come back and there's this sort of back and forth with the salmon. So they return and they spawn and then they die and then the baby fish go back out and then they'll come back. And that's the cycle of the salmon. And there were so many fish that when it was time for them to migrate back up the river for 24 hours, apparently you could hear them coming in the distance. And I mean, I have a stream on my land that's salmon should be here. And there are actually a few coho salmon, which is an absolute miracle. But you certainly don't hear them coming. I mean, it's like, there's a coho. We're like so excited. But no, they're not thundering. But there are people still alive who remember this. Like, it's not far distant in the past, 200 years ago, or, you know, somebody writing it in their journal that, you know, like, we can read it in a museum. These are people still alive. When they were children, they heard this. It wasn't that long ago. That's how many salmon there were right here. There should be 40 million of them, maybe. And they count them every year to see how bad it is. And okay, there'll be 32. Not 32 million, not 32,000. Literally 32 fish when there should be, you know, millions, like just uncountable millions. And that's what's been done. And that was the dams. You can't have a river with a dam. Like, it's, you get one or the other. You get a river or you get a dam. So what we have now is, you know, a planned spillway. That's going to be a bear. Did you hear that?
Really?
That's a bear. Yeah.
Are we good?
Yeah. They don't, we're not prey.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That bear is going to run the other way because she heard us. But yeah, they'll hear us and they'll be like, oh no, it's a person. Run. They're going to shoot us. I've tried to make them know that they are welcome here, but it's not like, you don't really want to shake hands with a bear. It's fine. Yeah. Like, they need their space. We need our space. It's all cool. But that's what that was when you heard that crashing through the woods. If you caught that on film, it'll be really cool.
Little bear, it's just us.
Bear,
you're not going to
little bear. Little bear. Probably just crept off into the distance.
It's like, I made a big noise. I should probably slink away.
Yeah, no, we're not going to hear it now. But that was a bear. That's definitely a bear. They heard me. They have really keen hearing, and they have their sense of smell is like, I don't know, 200 times stronger than dogs. So they can really smell stuff. Uh-huh. So if there's food, they'll come.
That's amazing. I love them in a spot where there's just bears.
That was a bear. Yep.
You don't hear the mountain lion, so I can tell you that was not a mountain lion, but it was probably was a bear. The mountain lion knows you're there. You don't know the mountain lion's there.
Oh, yeah.
Until it's over, essentially.
We live in Utah, and every once in a while, somebody gets snatched by a mountain lion. And it's always a runner, a trail runner, or a mountain biker.
Of course, because they trigger.
They wait for them to pass, and it's back of the neck.
Yep, it's over.
Down.
Yep. Not a bad way to go. I'm like,
lights out.
I'm totally fine. Like, if a mountain lion, because people are like, I can't believe you walk around back there at night. I'm like, A, we're all going to die. B, I'm not going to be afraid of mountain lions. I mean, I'm cautious, but I'm not going to, like, live in terror. But also, like, whatever. If I feed a mountain lion, honestly, I'd be so pumped, especially if it was a female that had pups or kits, I guess. I'd be so pumped to be part of that. Like, seriously, turn me into baby mountain lion food. I'd be like so happy. A wolf would be the only thing better. And we don't have wolves here. Not yet. We haven't had wolves. Once there was one, since I've lived here, there was one that dipped down from Oregon that was actually spotted in Crescent City. And I was like, yes. There will be wolves here again, but we don't, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to get eaten by a wolf, but a mountain lion could happen. So the bears were not prey. Like I said, they're not going to come in. We don't have grizzlies. The grizzlies are all gone from California, which is so sad, but, yeah, these bears don't eat people. So anyway, I'm sorry. What were we saying?
How much of the American prairie is left?
None. There's nothing left. There's like what they call postage stamp prairies. So you'll find tiny, tiny little bits where it's like, you know, 1 square acre, like 1 square mile or like 2 acres or whatever, like little tiny chunks. And what's really terrifying, I have never seen this, but apparently like, so this is the bit that's still, and then right next to it is of course the plow line, and it'll be like a drop of like 6 feet because all that soil's gone. And that's it. So there's little spots you can go to where people have tried to restore stuff. And that's really beautiful. So there's, you know, various like Audubon and different prairie societies that have tried. And they do have little bits where they've tried to bring it back and, you know, are saving rare species and all this kind of cool stuff. And those are just beautiful, beautiful efforts. But in terms of like functioning prairie, it's just, it's gone. Like it all got taken. There's just nothing left. It's just utterly horrifying. Like 99% of it is just gone.
It's almost better to not know that it was
there. I know. I know. Well, and then you think, I mean, I don't know about you. I've driven across things like Indiana and Ohio, and it's like flat as a pancake, and it's nothing but corn. And like, that was a wetland, people. That was so dense. It was just extraordinary stuff happened there. I don't know if you've ever read the Limberlost books, A Girl, the Limberlost. Yeah, these are like, I guess people don't read them as much anymore, but there's like a famous historic set of books about this little girl, Elnora was her name. And, you know, like she's this tough, scrappy kid from kind of a harsh background. And this was back before public school was free. So to go to school, you had to pay for it. And she's determined to get an education. And the way that she does it is through her, like her knowledge, but also her love of the swamp, the Limberlost swamp. Because I know this sounds so strange to us now, but people used to collect like moths and butterflies. And so, I mean, you had to kill them to do it. But so she goes out at night and she collects these moths, but it's just completely gone. Like there's literally nothing left of this place that was called the Limberlost. And it's super sad because, people go there to see it after reading the books. And it's like, sorry, it's gone. Now there have been efforts apparently over the last few years where they're trying to restore some of it, but that's tough restoring a wetland because the water's all been taken. Without the water, you don't have. I mean, it's just nothing. And Jean Stratton Porter is the woman who wrote those books. And there's just this absolutely gut-wrenching description she has of watching the place be destroyed acre by acre. And she's like, why? Like, what is this? There's this madness has taken over. Like, what are they doing? And they're just taking everything they can. And why? And it's just the horror of it all. The birds and the butterflies and just that the dense carpet of life that was there, and it like literally just got turned into a cornfield before her very eyes.
What do you think causes that like pathology?
Oh man, I don't know. Like, it's a chicken egg kind of thing, isn't it? Because once you've got this system set up, you have to keep going because everyone's going to starve if you don't. So you're stuck having to invade, having to take, which means you're going to have to vilify the people around you. You're going to have to dehumanize them, turn them into subhuman, you know, objects that you can kill and destroy and, you know, subordinate and turn into slaves. And all of that has to happen. So you're going to have racism and you're going to have, you know, just, you're going to have to suppress that human urge that I think is pretty central to humans to care for each other, to have compassion for each other, to feed each other. That's such a basic human thing. But you're going to have to subordinate all that in yourselves. You know, you're going to have to kill it so that you can go out and hurt your neighbors like that. And then once that gets institutionalized into your culture, well, now you're just going to keep teaching it and reteaching it to your children because half of them are going to have to be soldiers to keep this up. You're always going to need soldiers. So the boys especially are going to have to be taught to be, you know, little masculine warriors who can turn off their emotions and just kill on demand. That's pretty psychopathic, and it's a pretty horrible thing to do to little humans, but we do it on the regular. And girls, well, they're just going to be, you know, the breeding objects, essentially, who are going to get bought and sold as brides to be used as baby machines. So that's not going to be any fun either. So I don't know, like generation after generation, don't we get a little tired of it? I mean, I was tired of it by the time I was 4 years old. Like, I don't know what's wrong with everybody. And so that was like, for me, like, okay, I'm going to figure out why this is so bad and what do we do about it? But that was me. And I don't understand why everybody else doesn't have that impulse. Like, why did this happen? How do we stop it? And I don't know, because we didn't always do this to each other. That's quite clear from the archaeological record. It's not all just weapons and death and destruction and, you know, bones with their skulls bashed in and like that. Like, that's not a constant in human history. Like, there comes a time when we really start doing that to each other, but it's not always, and it's not forever, and it's not everywhere. We do get that this one pattern will make it inevitable. So I guess, you know, part of my job is like just trying to explain that to people. Because once it finally fell into place, it was like, now I have a name for it. I can call this thing civilization. There's other things that play into it, certainly like racism and imperialism and patriarchy. All of it, you know, plays a role. All of it is a part of it. But it does make there's a unity to it. Like, and it's all for this one reason, that we started destroying the planet. Then we had to take our neighbor's shit. Okay. Why did we start down this path? And that's what nobody knows. Like, why did humans start doing agriculture? Because it wasn't going to have a good ending. And there's theories, but I'm not sure which one is really going to win. Like, I don't know myself. I haven't decided yet which one I really agree with. The one that I find the most intriguing is the fact that these foods are addictive. That one speaks to me because I personally find it to be true. So there's a substance in especially wheat, so gluten, and it in most people's intestines, it turns into something else. We convert it to something called gluteomorphin, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a form of morphine, and we get high. It is a happy little hit. And that's true for me and my family, everyone in my family, everyone who's biologically related to me, like, oh yeah, that stuff calls my name. I know across town there are bagels. Like, I can go get one. And unluckily, whatever, I have autoimmune problems now. So I can't eat gluten. And it was like the best thing that ever happened to me, honestly, because it's so addictive. Like, I just can't stop eating it. So now it's like, it's not even an issue because I don't eat it and I don't have to think about it. But man, that's, you can just eat it. It just, it's bottomless. It's like, I'm sure this is how alcoholics feel. Like, you can never get enough. And so there is, you know, a theory that this is why humans did this. It's like, they got that happy little hit and then they couldn't stop having it. So it's like, it's worth destroying our land and, you know, working from dawn till dusk and having to conquer our neighbors just so we can get more of this. Seems reasonable to me. I don't know. Could be true. Who knows? I mean, the theory, you know, like what we're all told, I remember learning this in school in fourth grade, that humans overpopulated, there were too many people, and they lived with chronic hunger, and then they figured out this great thing called agriculture, and they were never going to be hungry again, because they could create more and more food, and then there was always food in storage, and they could just have food, so they didn't have to worry anymore. And that sounded like a good thing in fourth grade. None of it's true! The thing is about hunter-gatherers is like, they have beautiful bones and perfect teeth. They were not starving. There's definitely periodic hunger. So at the end of February in the Northern Hemisphere, probably things were a little bit, you know, thin on the ground. And they talk about like rabbit hunger, like when even the rabbits aren't fat enough. That would go on for a few weeks for sure. And you can see the evidence of that in the bones and the teeth. Like, yep, every so often it was, you know, probably a hungry winter. And so that you stop laying down in the bone and there's a line, you can see it. And you see that in their bones, but otherwise everything is just absolutely perfect. And they don't have degenerative diseases and, you know, are their teeth fit perfectly in their mouths and they don't have cavities. And it just seems like, wow, like that they just have this kind of perfect health. And then bingo, agriculture starts and everything falls apart. So suddenly you do see signs of mass starvation. In fact, they're living with it chronically, and like famine actually begins. Why? Because you're dependent on one crop. And if you don't get enough rain, you are all going to starve. This is not true for hunter-gatherers. There's always something to eat inside your land base, always something. And that's why you migrate a little bit. I mean, you have your home territory, but you know, in the summer we live here, in the winter we live here, you know, and in the fall we're moving through this area. And like everybody knows the migration route. It's all home and there's food everywhere you go. You know, seasonally, whatever, and everybody knows how to get it, and you know how to keep your population in check so you don't overshoot it, and it's all good. Not true for agriculturalists. You've got that one shot, and if things go bad, or if locusts descend, or something else crazy happens, there's a fire, you have nothing left, and now you are going to starve. And that's when chronic hunger becomes part of human life, is after agriculture, not before. And the other thing that happens, the moment people take up agriculture, immediately in the archaeological record, they shrink 6 inches and their teeth start falling out. So it's chronic hunger. I mean, it's not enough nutrition. So what happens when people take up agricultural diets is that the nutrient-dense foods, which are the animal foods, especially the fat, that gets displaced by essentially cheap carbohydrate, which is nothing but just sugar. So you're taking food that's absolutely dense with all the nutrients that humans really need, and you're replacing it with just sugar. So immediately diseases crop up that just have never been seen before in human beings. And their bones are short and brittle. They're riddled with all these diseases that have, you know, just never appeared before for humans, especially in the babies and the young children. Some of these conditions would have been incredibly painful. Just ugly stuff. And a lot of it's like iron deficiency anemia is quite clear in the bones. And that hurts, apparently. And you can die from that. So, like, children are starving. And, like, that's just, and it had never happened before. So that myth that we're told that somehow agriculture provided an answer to a question, and the question was human hunger, like, none of that turns out to be true. People were not chronically hungry. They actually were looking really good. That doesn't start till after people take this up. So that explanation doesn't work. I don't know. The agriculture does always start in river valleys, and that's because those are areas of great disturbance. And when you have a disturbance, what that means is the land is temporarily cleared. And so that would have been a flood. You know, every year rivers flood. So, you know, that would have meant that, I mean, you've probably seen the aftermath of a flood and what that looks like. The trees are knocked over and the soil is washed away and it's all muddy and, like, you know, not a lot going on there. It looks kind of scary. And that's a biological emergency for the planet. Like, you do not want soil exposed. So immediately, the first responders for nature are the annual plants. And so annuals have one thing going for them, and that is that they make really big seeds. They don't live very long. They really only live 2 or 3 seasons. And, you know, like all of life, there's this, you have to produce babies. That's the main drive. So that's their babies. They've got these really big seeds. And the annuals, they normally, you know, like here we are in a forest, and they're not going to compete against all these perennial trees. Like, they don't have the capacity to do that. The roots here are going to be way too dense. But if these trees were cleared away by, if there was a fire, the first thing that would happen would be this land would be covered by annuals. Because that's their moment. That's when annuals will spring to life, and they will cover that ground really quickly. And I use the image of like a Band-Aid. If you were to cut your finger, say, and you would put a Band-Aid over it, and then eventually the skin would knit back together and you wouldn't need the Band-Aid anymore. And that's what annuals do. They provide that Band-Aid and then eventually knits back together. Well, that's all the perennial plants coming back in with those, you know, incredibly dense root systems knitting back together and protecting the soil. That's really the point. So that's what annuals do. And in river valleys, there's a lot of annual plants, way more. And that's the reason, is because there's constant, semi-constant disturbances. So a lot more annuals have evolved to live in river valleys as there would be, say, just in a regular forest. Because there's so many in river valleys, humans figured out that a few of them were edible. It actually works. They're big enough to be worth harvesting. Because, like, this plant is going to have some seeds eventually, but they're going to be tiny. Like, it's not going to be worth the calories that it would take to pull the seeds off. But with annuals, yes, some of them are big enough to be worth it to humans to eat them. And so that's where wheat came from. And we probably found it just as addictive back then as some of us find it now. That might be the answer. I don't know. So it might just be that we have addictive little brains, and the gluten figured out how to kind of clue into that. And we did it. Could be. I don't know. I wasn't there, but
yeah. I think it's likely, you know. No one I've ever heard, it's like, it's long story short, it's just that, like, it's something we tried, and before we realized it was too late. It's too late.
Yeah.
Too big.
It was too big. We'd already done it, and then a population had gotten too big, and there was no way back because everybody was gonna starve.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that was it. We just kept taking. Yeah. And then it just spreads from every place where it started, it just spreads. And now here we are. Now we're gonna have to pull back.
Yeah. But I think both are very likely. We both really like this idea that we talk about all the time, the idea of adult knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean to you, and how did you have to learn that?
I learned this from a book that Martin Prechtel wrote, where he was living with a traditional group of people and as an outsider, and they had welcomed him in and they were, you know, sort of socializing him to their ways. And he had to learn about adult knowledge. They had a word for this that meant, I mean, it's obviously going to be a complicated concept, but my understanding, what I brought away from it was, you, to be an adult, you have to understand that you are connected to everything, that you owe your life to everything, and that you are responsible to all of those other beings. You, the humans, certainly, but all the other beings as well, that it takes all of us to make a living community, a biotic community. And that you don't, it takes time to understand that, you know, as you're maturing as a human, you know, our brains just take so long. And so he has the way that he finally learned that when he was, you know, being a guest and then a sort of resident in this community. And for me, that adult knowledge came on my way out of veganism, where I was trying to grow my own food. I was trying to be this really good person that was moral and ethical. And I wanted it to be true that my life could be possible without any death, that no sentient beings would ever be harmed by my existence. And that was my deepest wish. And I still wish that could be true, because it's really hard for me that animals suffer. I hate it. Even still, it's really, really hard on me that, you know, baby birds die, that, you know, I mean, I see bears every day and they get wounded just being alive. It hurts. And like, I hate it. Like, I want to help them. And I don't want my dogs to die. I cry about my dogs dying all the time just because, like, I know it's coming. I mean, it's years away, but I can't stand it. And it's just, I've always just been, I don't know. I know I'm not alone in this. Like, some of us are just that tenderhearted. Like, we just can't stand the thought that animals are suffering. And I wanted my life to be possible without ever harming a single animal. And the more that I grew my own food, the more impossible I realized that that was a fairy tale, that it wasn't possible. That even trying to grow lettuce was, I had to kill things and it was horrible and I didn't want to do it. And there was a little chunk of time in there where I simply stopped having a garden because I couldn't kill the insects that I had to kill. Insects are animals and they have incredible lives. And the more you get down into the soil and look at them, I mean, you see their little faces and it's all over. And you see how they behave. And like, ants are so social. And I remember once I had to move this little rock, you know, to make a little, it was in my garden bed and I just wanted to move it. And I picked up the rock. And of course, what's underneath is a little city of ants and it's their little nest. And there they all are. And I've made this horrible emergency for them. I've moved their protection. I've destroyed their house. And what are the ants doing? It's all the nurse ants. And every last one of these ants has grabbed a little baby ant, a little white, you know, whatever they're called at that stage. I know what they are. I can see what's happening. And they've got their two little front feet have got a little baby ant. And then on their other feet, they're running as fast as they can, heading for cover, like protect the babies. That's the first thing. And I just cried. I was like, what have I done? All I was doing was moving a rock. I didn't intend to hurt 100 baby ants. I've killed half of them. And the other ones are in a complete panic because, of course, they care about their babies. Just like I would care about a baby or you would care about a baby. And if you were inside a building on fire and there were babies, you would grab a baby. You would grab as many as you could and you would run. We would all do that. You would grab a baby puppy if there weren't any human babies. Like, we all know that. And there I was. I destroyed all those baby ants and it was awful. And and then there were the slugs that kept eating the lettuce. And like, there just came this point. I was like, I can't do this. I'm killing. I'm going to have to kill. And I couldn't make myself do it. So I stopped. I stopped gardening. And then I went to the store and I just was so relieved. It was like this huge weight off my shoulders. Like, oh, thank God I don't have to do this anymore. Cause every day was like this horrible dilemma. I was just being ripped in half with everything I was going to have to kill to try to grow my food. So I went to the store. I was like, I can just buy food. I don't have to do this. I don't have to face this. I don't have to think about it. I can just go back to being the person. No animals are killed and just eat my food and everything will be calm and peaceful. And I'm not a violent person and no animals are going to get hurt today. I'm just going to buy lettuce. And I held that lettuce in my hand. I remember standing in the store holding that lettuce. And that was it. That was the moment I grew up. It was that adult knowledge. And I thought to myself, who the fuck are you kidding? You know what went into this lettuce because you've grown lettuce now. You know what had to happen for you to get this lettuce. You might not be willing to kill those animals, but somebody killed them for you. There are dead animals in this lettuce. Especially if this lettuce is worth eating, there were lots of animals in that soil and around that soil and that came onto that land and wanted to eat that lettuce. There were deer, there were squirrels, there were woodchucks, there were bunny rabbits. You know what that farmer did to get this lettuce to you. So something dies, and it doesn't matter whether you kill it or some you pay somebody to do that for you. You're culpable. That was the thing. There was no way out. Like, so you're either going to pay a farmer a decent wage to do it for you and to do it well and to keep the soil healthy, or you can do it yourself. I mean, those are two options that are okay options, but at the end of the day, there are dead animals in this lettuce, and you have to finally face it. And that was it. That was the moment. And I just felt myself grow up. It's like I just put down the fairy tales and I had to do it. And it was really, there was this tremendous sadness. It's very bittersweet still. There's a tremendous sadness of like, there's death in life and I still hate it. I don't want it to be true, but it's reality. So you can't do it well if you don't face it. That's the thing. And there's no out. Like once you're here and you've been born, so many things are going to die to make your life possible. And so the only option at that point is just to accept it, to make a vow to do it well, to be humble before it, and just to be really grateful. Because here we are in this incredible forest, right? And there's bears and there's mountain lions. Maybe one day there'll be wolves again. And we get to see this, you know, we get to be here. We get, like, just to even look at the color green is so incredible. And we get to hear the birds and see the sunlight. And who couldn't be grateful to be alive, no matter what struggles and traumas we've had? And we've all had them, but it's still such an incredible gift every single day to be alive. And we just have to be grateful for it. But that's the cost, is that you have to be that willing adult who accepts our role, which it's not the easiest thing for me, but it's just reality. So now we have a choice. We can be part of the death that's killing everything. And that's agriculture. That's civilization. That's that whole, you know, that pyramid of just horrible things that we're all doing to each other. We can be part of that, killing the soil, killing the planet, 200 species a day. Like all of that death is right there in that system. Or we can be part of the death that means more life. So we can be participants again in biotic communities and play our role as apex predators. Do it well, do it humbly. Just take what we need and be grateful to all the kinds of life that are making our lives possible and make it better and stronger by doing it well. Like that's our only option. The death that's killing everything, the death that's part of life. But I had to realize there was no death-free option. And it was still just the hardest thing.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's tough.
I struggle with it too after coming out of my whole vegan experience, eating meat for the first time. Like, this is so weird.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing to this day. I eat
so
meat
hard.
And it's weird.
Yeah.
But there's no way out of it.
There isn't. There's no way out.
For my health.
I know.
For the planet. For any other living being.
I know. There's no way out of it. There's not.
And that's the conversation we're trying to have. It's like, you can be all upset about this, but you haven't escaped it.
I know.
Nobody's made it out yet.
You can't. It's like, you can't live on sunlight.
Yeah. Well, and like, my thing is always like, if you stop eating meat, that capo still exists.
I know, right? That doesn't help either.
Yeah,
I know.
It's like, I just feel like, you know, I'm not fully convinced about like, how much individual impact can do, like individual consumer decisions.
Not much.
Not much.
I mean, no. Really, we were fooling ourselves with that too. Yeah, like it's really not much.
I think it's like, if you can change culture, if you can change consumer culture, that's one thing. But, you know, I'm like, God, like, wouldn't it be better to give your dollars to like a regenerative farmer than Monsanto?
Absolutely.
Like, Monsanto's not doing anything to get rid of the capos.
I know.
The farmer might actually be able to have a way of like,
yes,
you know, supporting that, support the better meat, not the, you
know. It's so true. And
you can't abstain.
No, there's literally no way out. And it seems so stupid because this stuff can get so cliched. But when I was going through all of that, I had a friend who's, you know, she's Native American. And when I was, oh, this terrible death. And I was like, I'm crying and I'm upset. And she's so sweet. She just looks at me and she's like, I mean, like, I should have known this when I was 4 years old, you know? And she's just like, oh, you poor person. Like, it's just so sad you don't know this. But she's like, for something to live, something else has to die. And I was like, that's it. That's the sentence I needed. That's it. That's the entire thing right there. That's what I needed to know. I didn't know that. And I didn't know that because we live in a culture that's so separate from all nature. Like, I didn't know that. I grew up with some men, like a tiny little backyard. Like, I had no idea. So with so much compassion and love, she could just say that. And that's it. That's the whole wisdom that you need to be an adult for something to live. Something else has to die. It was all of it right there. And that's why I still remember it, because it's still, you know, the thing I remember. Like, that was the moment you grew up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. But it's definitely, like, it's a brutal realization.
Though, it's hard. It's so hard, especially when you've, like, banked on this idea that it's not, that you can get out and that right. You can live death-free and no animals are hurt and isn't it lovely and so peaceful and wonderful and yeah. I don't have to do that.
Yeah.
I don't have to hurt animals. And you do. You do. That's the thing. Like, you can pretend it's not true, but
yeah.
There's dead animals. No matter what you're eating, there is a dead animal in there somewhere and often entire species. So.
And this is kind of touching on the more, at least, hard limits of human biology and our ability to digest certain foods. We're always saying you cannot digest cellulose.
Yes.
We'd love to talk about, like,
sure.
Why, you know, maybe you could share a little about your kind of health falling and why, like, why was the vegan diet not working for your health?
Right. So the problem with a vegan diet, well, there's two problems. One is there's the problem of excess. And then the other is the problem of deficiency. Cause what you're essentially eating morning, noon, and night is a huge pile of grain. And that's just sugar at the end of the day. You can make yourself feel better by saying, well, it's complex carbohydrate. And in my case, that was true. I didn't eat junk food. Like, I was not a vegan junk food vegan. I was very much a whole grain vegan. So, I mean, I didn't touch white flour. I mean, I wouldn't even eat ketchup or jelly if there was sugar in it. Like, that's how pure I was. So everything had to be whole beans, whole grains, all that. But at the end of the day, for that to be digested, it's broken down into simple sugars. So it doesn't matter how complex it is here. I mean, by the time it's done, that's how it gets into your bloodstream, is it has to be simple. It has to be broken down to get through the border, the brush border. So that's what your intestines do. They break it down. So it is simple sugar at that point. So it doesn't really matter whether you eat the complex version or not. It's just a load of sugar. And our bodies were never designed for that. It's a very blunt instrument. What we have is insulin. So if you get a load of sugar, our brains especially can only survive within a very narrow range of blood sugar. If you have too much or too little, you will fall into a coma and you can die. It's quite serious. It's very dramatic. So the way that the body has evolved to respond to that is this hormone called insulin, and that's made by your pancreas. So immediately, oh no, there's a whole bunch of sugar that's invaded the bloodstream. What are we going to do? You get this surge of insulin released from your pancreas. And it's an emergency. I mean, it's a biological emergency. And insulin, this is how you know it's a very blunt instrument and that we really didn't evolve to do this. Insulin will grab everything that it can after that emergency signal. And it will shove it, you know, whatever nutrients are floating around in there, insulin grabs a hold and shoves it into storage in your cells. The problem is that now you have, your blood sugar is now going to be too low. Because it's not finely tuned. It says, grab everything. Hurry, hurry. Get it out of here before we die. It does that, but it does it too well. So now your blood sugar is too low. And now you feel really sick and you're shaky and you're crying and you don't know why. And, oh, the craving to eat is just absolutely overwhelming. You've got to put food in your mouth. And it's true. Your blood sugar is too low and your brain is really freaking out. So you're going to eat another snack and it's going to be another snack of sugar because you're a vegan. So you're going to eat another piece of toast or another piece of whatever, some peanut butter or another piece of granola or like whatever your thing is, you're going to eat it, a piece of fruit. now you, and you, so you've started the whole thing all over again because now there's more, your blood sugar goes back up. Oh no, it's too much sugar. More insulin. Shove it into the cells. Oh no, blood sugar's too low. Eat some more. So by the time I was done being a vegan, I was probably eating every 20 minutes. It was just grazing all day long because it was either too high, too low, too high, too low. Like just the roller coaster was absolutely insane. And one of the other things that your body uses when you're going through this is, adrenaline. Cause again, it's an emergency and your body responds as if that's true because it is true. So you're going to be exhausted from all that adrenaline too. I mean, it was just the emotions that go on when you're going through the cycle over and over again. And that was the first thing I noticed when I kind of, when I realized what I was doing in terms of the insulin resistance problem, the, which is inevitable on these diets. I mean, you're going to blow through your insulin receptors doing this. It was just how calm I felt, even within the first 6 hours of not being on that blood sugar roller coaster. It was like, how did I survive living with all that adrenaline and like that, just that craziness of feeling that, the low, the constant low and high thing. It was amazing just to feel calm, like a normal person. And I remember that first like 48 hours, just like, wow, it's just steady state. It was amazing. But anyway, that's the first problem is that there's too much sugar in these diets. So you're eventually, and all that insulin also, it just does tremendous damage. I mean, to all your organs, but it's a very inflammatory state. So it really, really damages the blood vessels. So all your arteries and your veins are going to get really damaged by this as well. And of course the brain. And a lot of researchers talk about Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes because they see that these things go together. Even if they're not quite willing to name an agricultural diet as the source of it, they do get that it has to do with blood sugar and that people who are diabetic get it way more. If you've got metabolic syndrome, you're way more at risk. And they literally call it type 3 diabetes. And there it is. Like you're just damaging your brain over and over again every time you do this. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that in eating all this grain, the thing about plants is they don't really make what are called omega-3 fatty acids. So this gets a little complicated. Animals, humans, we need both omega-6s and omega-3s. And we need them in a very specific ratio. And again, this sort of points to our evolution as carnivores. There's a conversion pathway that happens when you eat either omega-3s or omega-6s. Because we need them to become other things for our bodies to make use of them, to make it simple. But we don't make enough enzymes for there to be extra or for us to pick and choose. So whatever ratio we eat them in is the ratio that our body uses them in. So if we don't get the right ratio, it goes way off track pretty quickly. And the problem with eating an agricultural diet, a plant-based diet, is that plants have no need for omega-3s. They don't have any. The only way to get them is through animal products. I hate to say it, but there it is. That's a very hard, one of those sort of hard lines that you bump up against when you are a vegan. And it's all omega-6s. And the omega-6s are very, very inflammatory. Now, you need both. So the omega-6s inflame and the omega-3s calm. And to be a living creature, you do need both. I mean, your body needs both responses at different times. But you do need both. And the problem with, you know, the vegan or those, any of those kind of high carb, low fat diets is it's just all omega-6s. So it's all inflammation all the time. So this is over implicated in everything from depression to Alzheimer's to arthritis to autoimmune stuff. Like those omega-6s just set off that whole cascade of inflammation. And there's not really any way around it when you're a vegan. So that's another problem of excess from eating just these grain based diets. So those are the two main ones that you're going to get too much of. Then there's the problem of deficiency, and the deficiencies are just, that's a long scroll. So first problem is protein. All the protein that you're getting when you're eating your whole grains and beans is since they're plant-based, they come wrapped in cellulose. And as animals that have a single stomach that's highly acid, we don't have a way to digest cellulose. The only creatures on the planet that can digest cellulose are bacteria. And sometimes those bacteria work symbiotically with animals like the cow or with bison or, you know, name your ruminant, but that's how it works. So it's a really, really interesting sort of mini community that grasses and ruminants make with bacteria. You need all three of those creatures working together to make a prairie, to make a grassland. So what's happening inside a cow or inside a bison, they have those multiples, that multiply chambered stomach that we call a rumen. That's why they're named ruminants. And inside that stomach is, it's just a vast vat of bacteria. So it has to be very neutral, because if it's too acid, it kills the bacteria. They need a very neutral environment. So you think that a cow is eating grass. That's not actually what's happening. It's actually more interesting. The cow is eating the grass. She's at least biting it and swallowing it. Who's actually eating the grass is the bacteria inside her body. And then the cow is eating the bacteria. So it's a trade-off where the cow says, I'll feed you grass. Great. And you can live and you'll enjoy your lives. And then I'm going to eat you. And so the cow is trading in a really nutrient poor food. Cellulose, there's not much to it. The bacteria make use of it. That's what they eat. And then the cow in turn is actually eating the bacteria. So that's a high fat, high protein diet for the cow. That's what's actually going on inside a cow. Now, how this works with grasses is that grasses, when they developed in evolutionary time, they did something that plants hadn't done before, which is if you like look around this forest right now, like look at the trees, you'll see that the tips of all of the branches, it's a slightly lighter green. That's the new growth for the year. So most plants grow to the outside like that. They're growing out. Grasses are different. They grow from the bottom. So that's the growth point, is right there at the base of the plant, not at the tip of the plant, at the base of the plant. What this means is they evolved with ruminants to be eaten. Because if the growth was only at the tips and somebody was coming along and eating it, you wouldn't be able to grow. But because it's at the base, clearly it's meant to be eaten, because they can come right back after they're eaten. So you've got all of these creatures evolving together. You have this new kind of plant, you have this new kind of creature, and that creature is making a home for bacteria that have been around for a good long time. I mean, they're really ancient. But they make a symbiotic community. They make a relationship between all of them. And the reason this is really important for grasslands and why ruminants are so crucial to grasslands, the reason that a grassland is not a forest is because there's not as much rainfall. The moment you get more rain, you're going to get savanna, and then eventually you're going to get a full-fledged forest. But grasslands are very dry in the summer. There's not a lot of rain. And that's why they're grasses and not forests. So what the grasses do some incredible things. They build really deep soil. And the reason they build really deep soil is because that's a huge sponge for moisture. So it'll rain. There'll be moisture in the, you know, over winter in the form of snow. Then that melts in the spring. And then all of that gets absorbed into that very, very deep pad of soil. And then over the course of the summer, the deeply rooted perennial grasses will then, they will bring some of that moisture back up. That's what they live on. You know, over that long dry summer, that's why they're still alive. And most of a life will retreat from the surface of the soil because it's too dry over the summer. And some of it will continue to live deep inside, you know, where it's still more moist, where the perennial roots are keeping all that happening. But mostly where they continue to live is inside the bodies of the ruminants. So that was the kind of bargain everybody made. That's how they became a community to get together. And without the action of the ruminants, what you're left with is just weathering. I mean, that's the only way to break down the cellulose, would just be mechanical, you know, just rain hitting it and maybe once in a while a fire maybe burning it, but it's not enough. And so eventually that's just going to devolve into desert, because the dead cellulose will pile up, and it'll shade out the growth point of the plants. And then there'll be space between the plants as each one dies. And then those spaces get bigger and bigger. And without actual life, without actually a living plant there, it just turns to dust. And eventually you'll just have a desert. So that's what happens without ruminants. The people keeping that alive over the course of the summer are bison or cows or, you know, pick your ruminant. And they do that by giving the bacteria a home where it's still moist inside there. So again, you have the ruminant feeding the cellulose to that bacteria. Bacteria are having a good time eating that and then trading their lives back to the ruminant, who then keeps more of them alive. So everybody gets eaten, everybody dies, and then everybody comes again. And overall, It means you have life on a very dry place in the summer that's called a grassland. And every single person is needed. All of those creatures are needed to keep this going. You can't have one without the other. You can't have a grassland without a ruminant or a creature like that that has somehow evolved. I know it's a little bit different in Australia, but, you know, just set that aside. And these continents that, you know, where I live and where you live, it's, this is how it happened here. And so, yeah, we need cows. We need bison. That's who does it. That's who made it. That's who figured out how to make life happen in a climate that can be pretty harsh, both in the winter and in the summer. But they did a great thing because, you know, that soil can be 12 feet deep. Like, that's how much life is there. That's a lot. That's a lot of living and dying. That's a lot of roots. And yeah, and one square meter of a functioning prairie of a, you know, like a, what a prairie should be. In one square meter, you should have 25 different plants. Like, that's how many plants should be there. And all of that has been taken to just grow corn, wheat, or soy is essentially what's there now.
Fucking tell us about soy. Like, everybody's so convinced it's the same.
No, it's a nightmare, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. My God.
It's wretched.
Soy is horrible stuff. Yeah, it's not really edible. Gosh. All right. So there's a number of problems with soy as, we're all being told that we have to use soy as like a protein substance. If somebody wants to use soy as an occasional condiment, I don't care. Like, that's up to you. That's fine. There are traditional ways that people have eaten soy that are exactly that. They're highly fermented condiments. It's never actually a meal in those cultures. So, I mean, we can talk about why that actually works. But as we're being told to eat it now, I mean, just massive problems with soy. So the first one is that soy releases an enzyme that attacks a certain part of the hippocampus in the human brain. And that's the region of the brain that's responsible for memory. And this is why, even just anecdotally, I knew so many vegans who had no short-term memory. I mean, none. And I'm not talking about people who were 75. I mean, people who were under 30. Like, never knew where their car keys were, never knew where the wallet was, could not remember from day to day. Like, what is my schedule? When am I due at work? Where did I park my car? I'm not exaggerating. Like, to the point where their, you know, their loved ones just, it was like a running joke. Like, oh, of course she doesn't know where her shoes are. Why would she know where her shoes are? Of course she's 2 hours late to the meeting. She never comes on. Like, everybody knew. That's what soy does. It will destroy that enzyme that is necessary to make memories in the human brain. So that's not bad enough. Fine. We've got more. Soy has what are called phytoestrogens, and these are substances that look an awful lot like human estrogen, but it's not. So, you know, the thing is, plants don't really want to be eaten either, especially not their babies. And their babies are their seeds. So their seeds come wrapped in all kinds of other chemicals that deter animals from eating them because they don't want to get eaten. So, and there's a few exceptions. I mean, you can talk about fruit. That's the plant saying, oh, please eat me. I'll make it sweet and juicy and it'll be a pretty color and you'll be attracted to me. And that's because they want their seeds carried away. The seeds themselves generally will pass through, like, you know, the intestines of a bird or whatever, or, you know, pick your plant plants and animals tend to have, you know, kind of symbiotic relationships. So usually it's, you know, this specific animal or, you know, whatever it is. But for instance, birds, the birds that do not actually eat the seeds, they pass through to the other end. And that's one way that the plant spreads. So that's a symbiotic relationship where the bird gets the sugar and transports the seed for the plant. But aside from that, most seeds don't want to be eaten by animals because that's the end of the baby. That's going to be the end of their line. So they arm them with chemicals. And, you know, plants can't run, right? They don't have teeth and they don't have claws and they don't do the things that we animals do to fight back. But what they have done over the last, whatever, million years, they are nature's chemical warfare agents. So they have all kinds of ways to make chemicals to do some pretty amazing things, like talk to each other, like call for help, like feed each other. And in that long list of things they do is fight back against being eaten. And so this is especially true for their babies. And this is why, another reason that it's eating this plant-based diet, you know, it's just this huge load of what are called anti-nutrients all the time, because the seeds don't want to be eaten. They have armed their babies against us. And one of the ways that soy especially is absolutely genius at this, what soy did was said, all right, animals, you're going to eat me? I'm going to make sure you're infertile. I'm going to make super sure that you don't even have young that will come after me. We're going to make you learn the hard way. You eat me, you don't get babies. And that's phytoestrogen. That is how soy fights back. So phytoestrogen looks like estrogen enough that it fools our bodies, and it locks into the estrogen receptors that we have on some of our cells and obstructs actual estrogen from getting there, which means that we're kind of a mess reproductively. Because we need estrogen. Men need a little bit. Women need a lot. We all need it. And we're not going to get it if we eat soy. And what this means is that, oh my God, just the number of stories that I have heard, the horrors of eating soy. And I did this to myself too. So, I mean, like a lot of women who go vegan, my menstrual period just completely stopped. Didn't know why. No doctors could tell me. I stopped asking because it just didn't seem to be an answer to it. I was like, I don't know. What have I done? Who knows what the problem is? Oh, well, I'm just one of those people. And I didn't want to get pregnant, so it didn't really matter to me. I think this would have been a completely different story if I had wanted to have a baby. It would have been heartbreaking, I'm sure. Luckily, that wasn't my life trajectory, so it didn't add that level of grief to my story, but I certainly know women that have been through this. And yeah, it's bad. So you eat a lot of soy. That's one of the reasons that a lot of vegan women just completely mess up their cycles. And in my case, I mean, that went on for 20 years. And then I stumbled upon all the soy information, was completely horrified because I could see myself in every single one of the problems that are listed. Like, oh, I did that too. Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. I've really messed up that one. Okay. And then it gets to all the reproductive stuff. And I was like, what the hell is this the reason? And I went cold turkey on soy. Like after I read that stuff, I was like, I'm not fooling around with this one anymore. There's just no more soy. Took out the soy. And I'm not exaggerating. 2 weeks later, I got my period. Never missed another one after that. 28 days, boom, clockwork. It was so dramatic. It was so dramatic. I couldn't believe, you wouldn't believe it. Like if you put it in a novel, it was that dramatic. And it was the soy. That's what it was. My sister gave herself endometriosis from soy. And for a fact, that's true because, I mean, she was a vegan as well. So she's eating all the soy. She ends up with endometriosis, which is horrible, incredibly painful. There's not really a cure for it. Like nobody knows what to do for her. She's in agony 3, 4, 5 days every single month. And then she got a grant to go live in Italy to do her PhD stuff. And which was an amazing experience. She gets to live in Venice and like did all this, you know, like totally crazy fun stuff for a year. But she goes to Venice and what happens? The endometriosis completely stops. And it seems like this strange miracle cure. Was it because I went to this ancient church? Like who knows? Like anything could be true. And my sister has that kind of life. So like, I don't know, but it's just over. Like she can't figure out why. It's like, I'm not suffering. I can't figure out what's going on. She comes back to America. I mean, you know, the backstory here is, of course, you go to places in Europe, they have a traditional food culture. There's no soy. I mean, we'll just say no soy has invaded Italy. There's no soy. Okay. You can't get any of this stuff. A whole year she doesn't eat soy. She comes back to the United States. What's the first thing she does? Oh, I'm going to drink soy milk again. I missed my soy milk. Roaring back in comes the endometriosis. At that point, it's too late. There's no stopping it. Like she couldn't, once she realized what was going on, there was no pulling it back. It was too late. So yeah, 2, 3 weeks later, she's got horrible endometriosis, all the pain, the cramping, just absolute misery again. She can't figure out what's gone wrong. And years later, of course, as I discover the soy. And of course, I think about my sister and like, I got to tell you you just have to read this. I don't know what to tell you, but I think I see the answer here to what has happened. So of course she reads it all and all of her friends are still eating soy and drinking soy milk. And oh, isn't this the great thing? And she's just totally horrified. Like, and then she's like that year in Italy when it went away, I'm like, it was the soy. It was the soy. I don't know what else. It was the soy. And it was too late for her. She had to have a hysterectomy. Like, that was the only cure for it. So it's awful. And again, like, this could have been way worse in my family because she also just had decided she didn't want children. But, like, I know, like, just the level of grief that people go through when they find out they're infertile or, like, have to have these kinds of medical interventions. Like, that could have been really gruesome. And luckily, like, we ducked the worst of it by deciding that we weren't going to go that route. But I've certainly heard from women who have that level of pain and suffering from eating the soy. So, so there's that problem. And then another thing with the soy, with the phytoestrogens, is that it can provoke what's called precocious puberty. So a lot of girls who have been exposed to soy early and often will start getting like mini periods at a really young age. And I mean scary young, like 4 years old, like 2 years old. I've read the youngest one I ever heard about was an infant, and it was the soy formula. There's definitely countries in the world that have decided that it's not worth the risk, and you can only get soy formula with a doctor's prescription. So if your child is allergic to cow, allergic to goat, like all the more appropriate animal foods that one might feed a baby, you can get the soy, but they don't sell it across the counter because they know this. Like, they figured this out already. But one of the really bad stories that, you know, I just heard, you know, just sort of anecdotally, there's a woman who wrote to me, and it was, you know, the usual story. She'd been a vegan for many years. She was utterly confused by it. Her health was failing, and I mean bad. The same kind of problems I had with the joint problems and the bone problems. Like, she was just clearly crumbling, but she also had a 4-year-old child. And she, you know, you hold their hand. Like, what else can you do? Like, I know this is hard emotionally. It's absolutely gruesome to go through this. I know that it's going to be a really hard year for you. She had already accepted that she was going to have to start eating meat. But in her world, she had been so engaged in the kind of vegan animal rights world, she was going to lose every last friend and probably her job. And she knew that. And she was terrified. And like, I don't know what to tell you. It's like, yeah, you've been at that level, you've been in a cult. Like, there's no other word for it. Like, I am really sorry. Your life is really going to fall to shit. And all you can do is, like, try to find the good people and hang on to them because, yeah, you're going to lose everything. There's no good way through that one. And it was true. I mean, she did pretty much lose everything. But in her case, that was a whole other level because she had a 4-year-old child. And the girl was having precocious puberty. And that came out later in the conversation, which is like, I really need to talk to you on the phone. Like, she was so freaked out and she really had no one else to turn to. It was one of those, you know. And of course, my heart's just breaking for her. And then later, you know, like the next time we talked, she's like, so I'm going to talk to you about my daughter. And I heard that she had a 4-year-old, and it's like, you know, sort of cold chill of like, oh, I know where this is going to go, and it is not going to be pretty. So yeah, the kid's 4 years old and she's already developing breasts, and like, and this woman is kicking herself because her pediatrician had told her, I was like, don't do this to your, don't, just don't do this. And I see myself reflected in this because if I had been in her position, you know, at 30-year-old me, 20-year-old me, I would have stuck to my ideological guns. I mean, I was that insane about being a vegan. This can't be true. Soy is the food that's going to save the world. Nobody needs to drink cow milk. We don't have to oppress animals. That's just like dairy is, you know, animal rape. Like, you know, the kind of crazy stuff they say. I would have been that person and I wouldn't have believed them, even if I had gone to the pediatrician with my 2-year-old who was having weird problems. Like, if it came to it, I can totally see myself spending another 2 years feeding my daughter soy milk because I'm a vegan. And that's what she did, even though her doctor told her, it's in the records, in the child's records. Parent was told, you know, like, they documented it because they knew, like, this isn't going to end well. This woman is not listening. She's clearly, you know, an ideologue, and there's not much we can do about it. And the doctor had it all very, very clearly documented. And of course, at this point, this mother is just devastated at what she's done. And I, what can you do? And she's like, just tell me there's hope. And children are resilient. She's got a very young body. There's every chance she can bounce back. I don't know. So do I have hope for this child? I mean, yeah, that could happen. You withdraw the, you know, the biological insult. It's certainly possible, but at 4 years old, that's pretty bad. I don't know. And I don't know where it ended. She just kind of drifted away from me. So I don't have like an update, you know, 10 years on whether the kid is okay or not. Cause that, I mean, that precocious puberty stuff really sets kids up for lifetime of, you know, bad outcomes. So I don't know. But it was just, it was chilling to me to hear the story because I saw myself reflected, like, I know that I could have been that parent. And then you hear about the people who, like, literally kill their infants insisting that they're vegans. Like, wow, if you can override, like, your infant's survival, what is left? Like, that just scares me for all of us, like, as humans, that we can get that caught up in a religion, essentially, a fundamentalist religion. That we could just sacrifice our babies to it. And that really scares me too. Like, cause it, would I have let a baby die? I don't know. Would I have been that crazy? People do it. So I guess it's possible I could have been that insane.
That's why I'm so passionate. Cause I didn't, the moment I realized I got, you know, I got sad, irritable bowel.
Yeah. All of it. Yeah.
No sex drive. And immediately yeah, all of it. Out of it. But I was like,
yeah.
But then I just saw the intense vitriol where people yeah. stuck to their guns. And I just want people to have access to at least the information. It's yeah. just so hard because it is like this insane ideology. And it's just hard because the intentions are so noble. I get it, but it's just you don't have the information available to think otherwise. And it's very frustrating.
Well, look, what I always try to say to people is the values that inspire you to become a vegan are the correct values. So everything that underlies that decision to become a vegan, you're right. Like that, those are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need and like so desperately need that other world. So compassion and justice and, you know, anything that like values other beings and other creatures and like human humility and all of the, you know, all the things that we're getting wrong right now, like all of that is correct. Like it really is the only way that we're going to get out of this. It's just that maybe veganism isn't the best way to institute those values. And isn't it worth exploring? Perhaps you're wrong. I have found that it's easier to reach people before they've embraced veganism full on. Like when they're hearing about it and they're intrigued by it and they're thinking about it. Great. Think about everything. But let me tell you, there's better information out there. At least think about these other things. Like let me send you some books or some videos or like whatever. And there's other stuff out there because you know, I mean, I'll give you my 5-minute version of it, but this isn't necessarily the best way forward. Like, cause from where I sit now, I can tell you, this is actually the most destructive thing people have done to the planet. It's called agriculture. It's killed us all, like killed the planet, killed our societies, killed our health. Like all of these problems that really come back to this one mistake that we made a long time ago. And if you're willing to hear me through, I can try to walk you through why I think that that's the case. You can reject it at the end of the day, but I do find that if you can get to them first, like before they've gone full on, it's harder to pull them back. And I mean, it was impossible for me. It took me 20 years. So I do know what I'm talking about. Like I get that fundamentalist mindset. You know, I'm a fanatic. Like I know that. And the world only changes because of fanatics. So I say that like with some, you know, like there's some affection still, like I get it. We need fanatics. Like, and that will probably always be me on some level, but I did have to learn to temper it and I had to learn to put the brakes on that fundamentalism that clearly I'm capable of, you know, like even with all the best reasons, like it, that's where I went. You know, I wrapped myself up in my own little silo, destroyed my own body for it and could have done who knows what kind of damage to a child. Scary. Another problem with soy is that, so like a lot of plants, like I was mentioning, they have the seed coat, you know, has all these what are called anti-nutrients. And a lot of them, I mean, they do various things to hurt you if you eat them. And so one of the substances that most seeds have, they're called phytates or phytic acid, and they bind with minerals in your digestive tract. So even if you're eating a really like mineral dense, you know, if you're eating a lot of seafood and you're eating a lot of bone broth, if you eat enough whatever seeds you want to, you know, beans, grains, whatever, they're all seeds. If you're eating enough of that stuff, it doesn't matter. Like they're going to bind to all of those minerals and just take them right out of your system. You don't have access to them anymore. There's no point really in even eating them. So that's another problem. And that's the plant's way of fighting back. Like you eat meat, great, but you're going to crumble into dust. Like we're not going to let you have bones if you eat us. And that's another great way that they fight back. And then soy also, and so soy has a lot of those. With some grains and other kinds of seeds, you can kind of, you know, there's ways that you can process them, to try to outwit the plants a little bit, and you can try to sort of disable the phytic acid. And so some traditional ways of eating grains, like porridge that you would soak overnight, or like sourdough bread that takes many days for it to kind of sit and ferment. That's what you're actually doing. That's why traditional peoples used those methods. It disables the phytic acid. So now you have full access to your minerals again. So it's really smart. I mean, people didn't have microscopes, but they figured it out. And like, who knows how, but they did, which is kind of cool. But anyway, soy, so soy has a lot of phytic acid. No matter what you do to it, you can't ever get rid of all of it. And then another thing that soy does is, there's a thing called trypsin, which is a digestive enzyme that we produce to, digest our food. I mean, that's what it's for. And soy has a lot of trypsin inhibitors. So again, like the plant is saying, oh, well, you can eat my babies, but you're going to really hurt for doing this. And I remember the stomach ache I lived with every single day drinking soy milk. 45 minutes later, I got that stomach ache, and it was the trypsin inhibitors. It's like that was what it was. And I kept telling myself, you don't have a stomach ache from eating soy. And I did every single day. Like 4 years this went on. And it can be worse. There's people who end up with bloody diarrhea from eating soy, and that's what causes it. And I've got plenty of anecdotes about people in my life who did that to themselves. And they couldn't figure it out. Like, went to the doctor and swallowed the radioactive barium. Like, we don't know what's wrong with you. It must be this thing called IBS. And I'm like, I think it's the soy. Could you just listen to me? Give me like 5 days. With like just 5 days. Just don't eat soy. Tell me what happens. And then it's like this miracle cure. Oh, the bloody diarrhea stopped. What do you know? Yeah, it's the soy. It doesn't want to be eaten. Let's just leave it alone. But yeah, just ghastly stomach aches. I mean, I've known people who were like doubled over in pain from eating soy. And again, it was like, just give me a few days. So just try it. What have you got to lose? Just try it. I was like, it's over. I'm not doubled over in agony anymore. Yeah, it was the soy. Don't eat it. Just don't eat it. There's no good reason to eat it.
I was getting that way with nuts and seeds too.
Yeah,
I
know.
So many raw almonds, and that seems insane to me now. I know. Raw almonds. I eat one raw almond, and I'm like,
I know, right? God, right? Yeah.
It's the worst.
I know. And just the other day, I'm like, oh, that almond butter looks so good, and I brought the jar home, and it is yummy, right? And I sat there with my little spoon, and I had some. 2 days later, I'm still like, why did I do that? Like, you know where this ends. Why did you do that? You can't eat that. Like, you could have one tiny little, like, you cannot buy a jar of it, Liere. You know better.
Same.
And I did it, and it's so yummy. That's the thing. It's like salty, and it's like, oh yeah, the little fat, and like, it feels so, like, you know where, it's the stomach ache.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know you're gonna get it. And I did. I got a stomach ache, and I still don't feel great. And it's the fucking almonds.
She's always
it's dealing. Not edible.
She's always dealing with me because I don't eat all the time. I love dried mango, but dried mango to me is just excess fiber. It's just a shitload of fiber.
Oh God, it hurts. Yeah.
And I always eat too much, and then I'm just like constantly.
Oh, it hurts.
Yeah. It was sugar and fiber, and I now have to wait for 3 days to digest anything else.
I know.
And meanwhile, when we just eat meat, we're like,
it's fine. Yeah. Like nothing happens.
Perfect.
Tuna fish, steak, like it doesn't matter. Chicken, doesn't matter. Like it's all just like, it's fine. I don't feel anything except happy.
Yeah. You don't feel overly full.
Nothing. Just perfectly fine. Eggs too. Like just perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. just all good. Like, oh yeah, I was fed. That feels fine.
Yeah.
It's just so crazy, isn't it? I know. I just did that with almond butter. I hadn't done it for like months, and I was like, oh, I saw it was like on sale. I was like, oh, it's only $5. Just get the little jar. You can just eat a little bit. I can never just eat a little bit. I sat there with a spoon. I didn't eat the whole jar at once. Like, don't get me wrong. But it was enough. Yeah. Like, okay, here comes the stomach ache. Why? 4 hours later, I still have it. It is. It's been like 2 days. I still have like a little bit of a stomach ache.
It's the
fucking almonds. Like, why? I could eat like 3 almonds. It would be all right. But I don't ever just do that, especially not the almond butter, because you can just eat it with a spoon.
Yeah,
well, it's that satiation. It's the mind game of eating something. Your brain being like, I didn't get what I needed from it. So you're going to keep eating that thing no matter what.
Because it's not actually like creamy fat. It's like fake fat. Because it's an almond fat. It's
well, you craved it because you wanted
it's not
fat.
Bacon. Just eat the fucking bacon. You'll be fine. I didn't eat the bacon. I ate the almond butter.
I'd really love to talk about water. And you talk so beautifully in the book about the Mississippi.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking tragedy. And we are just in Central Valley. You see these huge artificial canals shipping in water from who the
fuck
knows.
Horrible.
It's terrible. So maybe you could talk about water and agriculture.
Let's see. So one of the other problems with growing annual crops over and over again, and so the annuals would be those monocrops that humans are now dependent on, you know, like corn and soy and wheat. They need a lot of water. They don't have really dense, deep root systems. And that's one of the ways that annuals and perennials are really different. That's sort of the dividing line. Perennials live a long time, so a whole bunch of years, however long. Like, I mean, these trees are going to live 2,000 years. And the annuals really live just that one season, honestly, just to make babies and die. That's what they do. But in that short period of time, there's no way to make big bodies. Like, nobody's going to grow a tree in one season. That's just, it's not possible to get that big. And likewise, their roots just aren't going to be that big either. It's just a time limit thing. It's just, they've only got that much time. So their roots aren't big. Their bodies aren't big. The one thing that's big on them is just that seed, which is the thing that humans will eat sometimes. But other than that, there's not a lot going on. So they don't have deep roots. They're really pretty dependent on the perennial plants. And there are annuals in nature. It's not like annuals are bad. It's just they have a very specific role. And normally their role is really first responders. So when there's been a disturbance or an emergency, that's when the annuals will come to the fore. And they'll quickly cover the soil, but in a few years they're gone. So if there's like a fire or a flood or an earthquake, that's when you'll see annuals quickly after that. And then they sort of disappear from the landscape until there's another one. So they don't have, you know, the deep, deep kind of root system that perennial grasses have. They're annual grasses. And when they do, you know, appear in the land, they are dependent on those more deeply rooted perennials to provide water for them. That's who's making the water storage happen, and that's who is providing water to the rest of the community while there's no rainfall happening. And that's usually for most of the summer. You know, in most places, there's not going to be a lot of rainfall. And so everybody's really dependent on that sort of symbiotic relationship between deep soil and deeply rooted perennials, and including the annual plants. So what humans do by destroying all of that and then just trying to grow annuals is you have to apply water. I mean, there's no other way to get them to grow. So you've probably seen this, you know, the flyover states as you're flying over and you see those big weird circles. That's the irrigation equipment that shoots it out. And of course it makes a circle. It makes a radius like that. So you're going to see those giant circles. And all that water, where does it come from? Well, one of two places, and the first is they're draining rivers. So the Mississippi is essentially just a cement spillway at this point, and all the water is just taken. You could say the same for the Colorado. All the major rivers in this country, and indeed around the world, have just been devastated. I mean, they're exsanguinated. I mean, the world has just been exsanguinated. They've taken the living waters of the planet and spread it across this dry, ever desertifying landscape in order to grow this monocrop that, you know, we've all been told is the food of peace and justice somehow. And it's not, it's all dependent on the exsanguination of the rivers. So that's one place it comes from. And then the other place that they're getting the water is they're pumping it out of these aquifers that are, you know, deep below the surface of the planet. And they're ancient aquifers. I mean, some of them have been around for like hundreds of thousands of years. And when that water is gone, it's gone. It's not going to be replaced. I mean, they may slowly refill because it's water is just going through tiny little cracks and it takes a long, long, long time for it to fill up. And at the rate that they're pumping it, it's not replaceable. And so they're getting it all. They're taking all the water. And the big one is the Oglala Aquifer in the Midwest. And they are now using oil drilling equipment to get down deep enough to get to the last of that water. So, you know, we've got fossil soil and we've got fossil fuel, and this is fossil water is what it is. It's been accumulating under there for God knows how long, and they're just going to take it and waste it, and that'll be the end of it. And it's for what? For more corn? Like, we needed more corn? The whole thing is insane. And, you know, the kind of thing that you never really think about, but inside those aquifers, there have to be little microscopic creatures, some kind of bacteria or somebody lives in there. And that's their home. That's the only place they can live. So, you know, they're being driven extinct too. So I mean, we don't tend to care about them, but we should. I mean, they are our kin. We do need them. They are playing some function, some role. They've got something they're adding to the community of life. I don't know what, but we all do. So they are, and they're being wiped out too. So none of this is benign. I mean, all of it is really just more death and destruction added on top. So that's where the water comes from.
Dead rivers, dead aquifers.
That's it.
It's so interesting, like, this paradox that I'm noticing where, like, vegans are, like, are on one hand so against speciesism, but then they also don't acknowledge the fact that all of these species are so integral to,
I know, to everything.
Yeah. It's like, to everything. It's so bizarre. It's like, you can't, if you care about a, you know, a human more than a cow, then, like, you're a fucking,
you're a terrible person, and you get to be canceled, and we're gonna kill you. Yeah.
But it's just so, that's such an interesting paradox I'm noticing.
It's very real too, yeah, with that paradox that they ride. Because I mean, I did it for years, and it doesn't make any sense at the end of the day. And the big one that I always had was, you know, meat eaters would be like, oh, you think that, you know, how can you put, you know, this kind of, you know, moral care on a cow or a chicken? Like, don't be ridiculous. Humans are the only ones that count. And I, you know, would fight back like, well, no, like, all life counts. And this is important, and animals are people too, and, you know, blah, blah. But then I was doing the exact same thing to plants. And then it was this horrible dilemma for me all each time, because it's like, so if plants get included in sort of my circle of moral care, then I can't kill them either. What am I going to eat? So I didn't want plants to count. Like, I had to keep plants on the other side of the line where they're not sentient. They don't count. Their lives don't matter. They don't want to live. They don't care if they die. They're not people like me. They're not beings that I need to care about. They're over there. Animals, yeah, they're like me. Plants, no. So I was drawing a line. But then I would argue with the meat eaters about, you can't draw a line. All of life is wonderful. And you just blah, blah, blah. And we all count. And I was like, you don't actually think that. You don't want that to be true. You can't have that be true, because then you have to acknowledge that you're killing sentient beings too. Only they're called plants. And it was terrible. Like, it was this real dilemma. And I never could resolve it. And at the end of the day, I didn't resolve it. I was like, I just have to stop drawing lines, because it's a circle. And I'm a human now, but plants are going to eat me, and then animals are going to eat me, and all these molecules are going to just get dispersed, and I'm going to be a bird, and I'm going to be a trillium, and I'm going to be a redwood, and who knows what else. Like, it's just going to keep moving. And it's a circle. That's all there is. So do I make the circle stronger, or do I hurt the circle more? Like, which, those are my options. But that's it. There's no lines to be drawn.
You have this beautiful line that says, the further we move from hunters to agriculturists to industrialists, the farther the sacred receives to I think, then to heaven, then to, you know,
right.
What does that mean to you? And what is that sense of the sacred, and how has that allowed us to do what we've done to the planet?
I know it is. It's got me totally stumped. Like, gosh, what am I talking about? I think the oldest human understanding is that everything is alive, which is another way of saying that everything is sacred. So it's rocks and rivers and rain and plants and bacteria and animals and everything. Every living thing has some spark of that, some spark that's like the divine, the sacred, that we're all part of the all. And then we forgot that because we had to dominate it. And to me, that's like, that's where the wound begins. And I don't know, maybe someday I'll figure out that that's wrong. But what I've come to understand through this whole long journey of my life is that it seems to me that the wound begins, the breakage begins when humans take up agriculture and we start this wholly different way of life that's about destroying rather than participating. And the destruction begins when we clear the life off a piece of land. And we take that land and we only use it for ourselves. So none of the other plants and animals get to live there anymore. In fact, they're driven extinct. You know, as we take over continent after continent, all of them are gone. So the plants, the animals, the little tiny bacteria, everybody, the huge megafauna, all of that life is just removed. And in order to do that, there has to be some way that we break ourselves from them, we break our relationships to them, and we see them as objects that we are allowed to use in whatever way we want. If we recognize that sacredness inside them, we wouldn't be able to do that to them. It's different than just killing, because every living thing depends on the death of other creatures. So to me, I originally thought, well, this clearly killing is the bad thing. So I want a life where there's no killing. And that led me to do that whole vegan world that I entered was about, I don't want to be the one that does killing. And I wanted there to be a way out of that. And it turned out that there wasn't. But, you know, coming back into that more, oh gosh, all the things that I had to understand and to learn about how the world works and that I was a participant in it and that there was no death-free option, as hard as all of that was, it let me see again that the world, that every living thing was sacred, and it wasn't just me and animals that were like me, that it really was the plants too. And then little tiny things that we can't see, like the bacteria and all the creatures that live in the soil, like one tablespoon of soil contains a billion living creatures. And they're the ones that are doing the basic work of life. Like none of the rest of us are possible without them. We can't even see them. But that's what we're destroying when we do agriculture. So for me to think that like agriculture was the way forward, that was about peace and justice and goodness and, you know, like this spiritual understanding, like it's just completely wrong. Because we're killing that soil. We're killing all of those creatures that like we can't live without. But all of them have to be inside, you know, that circle of our sort of moral care. And it's because, like, ultimately, we have to know that we all are part of the whole. We're all part of that. There's a sacredness in everything because all of us are alive. And it's a different kind of life if you're a rock. It's not quite the same as being biologically alive, but I still think it's alive. I mean, obviously, it doesn't, you know, start small and grow big and then, you know, reproduce or bud or whatever they're going to do. But they're alive. Like you can talk to rocks, and it's hard to talk to rocks apparently, but they're very ancient beings and they're kind of cranky. Like that's what everybody says about them, but you can do it. Like you can wake them up, you can talk to them. And they have a very different kind of wisdom than other living creatures. Right. But that's the substrate of all of us. Like we're all made out of minerals. That's what life is a dispersive rock. It's like our bones. Like that's what it is. Like we have to have minerals in our blood or we die. And it's the rock people. Like that's the basis of this family, this tribe called Carbon, is the rock people. And they're there. They're right underneath everything. I mean, maybe that's too woo for some people. I don't know. But I think it's true. And I've had experiences that tell me it's true. I can't really convey those experiences to other people. I also don't need to. Like, I don't care if I convince other people. I just know that that's true. I also know that the cultures that remember that were able to live where they lived for thousands of years without destroying anything. And it's the cultures that have forgotten that have laid waste to continents. So I think there's something important in remembering that everything, it's possible to enter into relationship with everything. You know, whether it's faraway stars, whether it's the falling rain, whether it's the morning mist, whether it's the redwood trees, they're all beings that there's a way to communicate because we're all made out of the same substance ultimately. And that substance is that sacred thing, like whatever word you want to give it. And every culture has words for it. So whatever we want to call that, that's what we are. So, you know, the rock people have it and we have it and the redwood tree people have it and we all have it. And that's why we can communicate. And that's why relationship is possible, is because we really are made from the same, that same thing. And we're all going back to that same thing. You know, it's like this temporary journey, sort of back to it and then back out and then back in and the whole, and then we differentiate, but then we get to go home. And I don't know. I think that that's what the universe is. And it's, I mean, it does get kind of cosmic after a while, but if we don't let that awareness back in, I don't think ultimately we're going to save this planet. Cause that's what we had to kill to be able to destroy all of it. And that's what keeps that destruction going, is that we've learned how to separate ourselves from the rest of it. And I don't know, a lot of people, you could call this sort of a biophilic awareness, you know, like that, the connection and that love for all the other beings. And I don't know whether, once that's killed in a child, I don't know if it's possible to always bring it back. I think that everybody's born with it. I don't think that there's a child born that doesn't have it. I don't know how that would be possible. I think we all have to have that when we come into this world. So I think the process is how is that sort of beaten from us one way or another? And then can it be revived? But I think we're happier when we have it. I think there's a great joy in connecting to that. And I've seen that on the faces of children who haven't had access to the natural world, ever, have lived in just really grim kind of urban environments, until they're, like a 4-year-old who didn't know the word tree. I'm not making that up, just had never seen a sunset. And you're able to provide them just even with a few hours of being outside in the green and seeing that first sunset, or feeding, going to feed the ducks with him. And it was this just amazing thing to watch this little kid just for the first time get to experience that kind of that biophilic awareness. And he utterly responded to it. I heard this story once. I read this story about just an awful thing. This was a mule, I think, that was kept in a mine to haul the, I'm assuming it was coal, but I don't know. And they finally let the mule out into the sunshine, and the poor thing was so happy, just absolutely ecstatic, just jumping and clicking little heels together and stuff. And the men who were running the mine, they couldn't bring him back in. It was we just can't, it's too awful. And they let him go. And I'm going to start crying, but that's how I felt with this little boy. It was you get to be out of the mine. You're going to be in this other world now, just even for a few hours, where there's green trees and there's birds. And he had never seen any of it before, but he responded to it like a living creature that loves its home should. Sorry, I don't mean to be so sentimental, but that's why I think there's still hope. Because I think there's probably a part of us that's just like that mule or that little boy, that we know how to love our home, we do. We're those animals too. Oh, well, I wrecked that, didn't I?
Oh, my God.
That was my little cousin, honestly. He's a real kid. And it was just, they were just living in hell. It was horrible. But I remember the first time we took him through the trees, and he just looked up and he looked at the green, and he's like, "This is good," he said. And it was just oh my God, it's so true. He knows it's good. He doesn't even know the word for tree, and he knows this is good. It was so incredible. Oh, that poor kid. He was being utterly abused too. So, it was also tragic. Anyway, that's where we are. Welcome to the world, right?
Beautiful. Thank you for trusting us enough to be able to be emotional too, because we're really emotional.
It's just horrible.
That's how we feel about it. And it's a few days ago I lost my family dog.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh my God, it's okay.
It was really hard.
It's horrible.
She was a sweetheart.
Yeah.
And it raised a lot of questions about death.
Sure.
And our relationship.
Yeah.
To nature and how.
It's so final.
So final. And how painful it is that we're so disconnected. Like the little boy who got for the first time.
Yeah.
This is good. And that, we're talking about a lot of these things because we feel it's so important for us to be talking about death so that we can be biophilic.
Yeah.
And in its own right, that experience of death, as painful and as hard as it is and will always be, gives us that sense of the beauty.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's literally the same moment. Like, the death is life. Like, it's that transformation. And like, that's, we have to remember that's the sacred part of the cycle, is that it's always in transformation. But it's so hard because as humans, it's, I mean, we mourn. Like, it really hurts us. We get so attached. I do think it's easier for animals. You know, I think they get over it faster and they're stronger for it. You know, like, it's, I think it's a way that we, I mean, it's the, I don't know. It's like the joy and the horror of everything, right? But I think that's like, that's, I think it's one of the hardships of being human, is like, I think we have, we're able to separate from it more. And it, I think it's what hurts us more, you know, like, I think for animals, it's just more, they just go with the flow better. Like, for us, like, we really get attached and we have to learn to get, we have to learn to have some distance, or like, we'll just die from it, you know?
Well, and why do you think death is so hard for us? I was talking the other day and I was just like, the only reason why I can imagine death hurts so much is to force us into more presence in our day-to-day lives, to make, to force us to really, really be with each other.
Yeah.
And to really take care of the life we have.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I don't know how to justify.
Yeah, I don't either.
To justify grief. I don't know why it's there.
Yeah, I know.
I guess on a basic level, it makes us a survival instinct, but not to the degree that we feel pain. I would want to fight for my life with just a little bit of grief.
I know, right?
But the amount of grief we feel, I don't know how to rationalize it.
It makes you vulnerable. Like,
yeah, it makes you vulnerable.
Like, we are so incapacitated.
No, I know, I know. Yeah.
And, you know, just like that feeling, like, I mean, it still comes in waves, and it's like,
it's awful.
Yeah, the grief, like, we were talking about it, and it's like, it doesn't serve a utilitarian function.
No, it
like,
doesn't. You know, people die from grief. Like, literally, they have heart attacks. Like, yeah. Like, we, you know, all those stories, like, the one spouse dies and then 9 months later, the other one dies because they just can't do it. They can't do it. You know, it's like, I totally get that. Yeah. And that's like the really common story. Like, grief kills people, or like people who have, you know, a child die or something, and like, they never get over it. And like, it's just awful. Like, when Carrie Fisher died.
Oh my God.
And yeah. It was like the same thing.
It was like the very next day.
It's like, yeah. Who could blame her? Like, it's like, who wants to live through that? Like, I totally get it. Like, I'm just done. Your heart gives out.
Yeah.
Like, it just physically gives out. Like, it, yeah. It's bad.
It's so beautiful, though, is that connection with each other.
And love.
Yeah.
It just reminds us about that love is like,
it's really so true. I know.
That's the thing that, like,
and that's the tragic thing that we've missed, which makes it so much harder
to
see what's going on with the world, is that how much we missed the point.
And every last living creature is under assault now. Yeah. Every last living creature.
Yeah.
It's everything.
Yeah. And it's us probably more than anything in a lot of ways. Because
it's so bad.
We're destroying our psyches.
As we go, yeah. Yeah, it's so true.
For people who are feeling it.
Yeah.
A lot of the young people have so much of their life yet to live, and just see, like, I don't know if I'm going to make it to old age. Like, shit is so, like, what advice do you give to people to walk on this earth and still do it with happiness and joy and feel like they're helping, you know?
I think we're all better off if we acknowledge the grief and the terror, because those are quite real right now. Things are bad on this planet. Like, they're so bad. We really might be looking at the end of everything. I don't just mean humans. I mean everything. The global warming stuff especially is just... And that's only one of the issues. Like, there's all the others, too. Like, every biological indicator is headed in the wrong direction. And the pace of that is only accelerating. So we have every reason to be really depressed, really upset, really angry. And I think we're better off feeling it. Like, don't pretend you don't feel it, because it's there. But it's also good to know that, like, none of those things are going to kill you. That it's all right. Like, holding it off is honestly worse. Just let yourself have your despair if you're in despair. It's perfectly legitimate to feel despair. But keep going. That's the thing about despair. Like, you can pick it up and put it down. Don't let it consume you, because then there's no point. Honestly, we need you. Like, whoever you are out there, like, we need you. The planet needs you. Whatever you love needs you so badly right now. This is it. This is our last moment. you know, to put on our big kid clothes and fight for what we love. So this is it. So we need you. Like, don't sink into that despair. But the despair won't kill you. That's the thing about it. That's the thing about grief. It's the thing about, you know, having a broken heart. Like, okay, it may be broken, but it's still made of love. And you have to let that love bring you forward and be the thing that moves your life. It just, it has to. It has to be the thing that is in your voice and in your hands and in everything you look at. Just remember what you love and why you're here. And this is the last moment. Like, you were born now for a reason. You were, all of us were. And this is the reason. Like, we've got to be that resistance. We have to fight for what we love before it's too late. Because it's going to be too late too, very, very soon. This is it. It's our last moment. I don't think it's too late now. I think we can still pull this back. Even if the world looks really different than what it's looked like for the last 10,000 years, there's still life, you know, and as long as there's some life, the rest of it will fill in. So I am not giving up hope, but I am not a person who's going to stop fighting no matter what. And that's just my nature. Like, I know I'm stubborn. So that's it. Like, take it to the end. It's fine. I'm going to go down and I'm going to take out as many motherfuckers as I can on the way down, but I'm not going to give up. I mean that metaphorically, but I'm not going to give up. I'm not. There are people who have already given up. And you'll hear this a lot, like the people who say, well, it's all going down, let's just have a party, or it's all going down, so let's just mourn, you know, we just have to mourn the planet. And I'm not at the mourning stage, people. Like, there's still life here, it's still worth fighting for. I mean, if, like, you know, your mother or your sister or your beloved dog or somebody was, I don't know, had been hit by a car and was still breathing, you wouldn't be, like, making the funeral arrangements. You'd, like, you'd pick them up. Like, you would use every bit of strength you had to get them to a hospital and then do whatever needed doing to, like, keep them alive, right? And you'd be giving them mouth-to-mouth resuscitation the whole way, or, like, whatever it was, you know, like, holding the wound shut, like, compression, like, whatever the thing was, you would do it. And it's the same. Like, our planet is not over yet. Like, we can't give up. We have to keep fighting. So even if there's a lot of grief and a lot of despair and a lot of rage, and those things are quite real, we can't take our eyes off the prize. And the prize is stopping the destruction. Like, even if we can't figure out how to repair it all, it doesn't matter, because the earth knows how to repair it. Like, those forests know how to come back. Those prairies know how to come back. Those wetlands absolutely know how to come back. And every last river knows how to flow if we just take out the dams. So all we have to do is stop the destruction. It's not honestly that hard, because we know how we're destroying the planet. We just have to stop. So, all right, we have to confront some rather large systems of power, but they're human, you know? They're not mythical, and, like, they're not supernatural. They're not actually vampires and zombies. They're just us, and we can do this. So we have to. That's the thing, right? If you love something, that's it. Like, it's under assault. We've got to fight. So, like, bring your heart. And we just got to get this started.
Whatever that looks like.
Whatever that looks like. And it's going to look different for everybody. I don't, like, have a prescription for everyone, but, like, bring whatever you've got. And we've just got to get it moving.
But what do you want to have happen to your body after you die?
Oh, you know, I haven't really decided yet. I mean, I guess the options really are cremation or burial. I don't know. The thing about burial is, like, I know this sounds weird, but it makes me feel kind of sad, because if I'm buried, but then, like, nobody tends my grave, that just seems really lonely. So if you're cremated and then they sort of, you know, somebody can just sprinkle my ashes, like, it's just done. Like, there's nothing that needs to be tended or memorialized ever again. Like, it's just great. Just sprinkle it all around and it'll just immediately get taken up into plants and that'll be the end of it. And then nobody has to worry about it anymore. So I might go that direction, but I also do like the idea of getting eaten, just directly eaten by, you know, microbes and worms and whatever else is in there. I don't actually know that much about what happens under the ground, but I assume it's, you know, a bunch of stuff eats you. So I kind of like that idea too. It's just like that sort of long, lonely period when, like, nobody remembers me and I didn't have children. So, like, who's gonna Like, how does the grave get, like, just do somebody plant flowers? Or, like, what happens? Does it just sort of fade into oblivion? And I mean, I guess that's true for every single grave. Even the pyramids are going to crumble eventually. So, like, I guess I shouldn't be too attached to that. But, I don't know, it just sort of makes me sad. Like, those old graves that, like, clearly nobody's around to take care of anymore. I'm like, well, it just sort of seems, I don't know, there's this sort of lingering sad thing to it. Whereas, like, just sprinkle the ashes, it's done. So I might go with that. I don't know. It's not really going to matter because I'm going to be gone. So, like, I'm not going to be around to feel sad about it if, in fact, there's a sadness to it. So I don't know.
Alrighty, thanks everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as we did.
Please leave us a review and rate and subscribe on whatever app you use to listen to podcasts.
Anything helps, you know, any comment, like, and subscribe, it helps us get noticed more on these things, especially since we're a new podcast.
Yeah, and thank you to Danny Osterstock for the music. Have a good day, everyone.